Coming up on today's Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King starts things off. We know who won last Tuesday, but will the GOP takeover mean even more D.C. dysfunction, or will compromise finally emerge? Then we'll ask you what you think of the president's Friday announcement doubling U.S. military advisors in Iraq, and whether it's time to talk about a draft. Then the GM of the T, Beverly Scott, joins us in studio to discuss more cars, more rider-friendly alerts, but less money to pay for it all.
Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on millennials quitting their jobs with no place to go. Are you one of those millennials? Are you the parents of one? Then WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen on the latest in film, theater, and museums about town. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I want to say in honor of Veterans Day, we're going to be joined in a little while by one of our most distinguished veterans, newly elected to Congress, Seth Moulton from the 6th District, is going to join us to talk about all things veteran, including this new number of troops that are going to be deployed to Iraq.
And on the other end of the political spectrum, the only blue, Marjorie, I think you see in D.C. these days comes from the huge bruising the Democrats took in last week's midterm elections. But you wouldn't know it to listen to Josh Earnest, he's the White House spokesperson, going back and forth with the press corps in that room at the White House.
Okay. Republicans so bad for Democrats.
Well, I know that is the mentality of Washington, D.C. I also think that's the kind of mentality that voters aren't very happy about.
You're saying it could be good for Democrats.
Well, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I'm not going to pass judgment on the...
You can say it's good for Republicans, but you can't pass judgment on whether it's good or bad for Democrats.
Right. It's fine. It is. I'm certainly disappointed in the outcome of the elections. The president is, too.
You know that old saying, losing is the new winning, Marjorie. Joining us on the line to take on this and other national headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John, as you know, also hosts Inside Politics. Hey there, John King.
Happy Tuesday. Week after the election. We're still sorting through the rubble.
Well, exactly. That's why I'm so anxious to talk to you, because we haven't talked to you since the results came in. John, we often talk to you from these far-flung places where you're out traveling around the country, meeting with people and stuff. And I'm wondering, what's your sense, having been a reporter for a long time, having seen all these different people in different states, what do you think this election meant?
That people are mad at everybody, that they're a little bit more mad at the president because they view him as the CEO, and rightly or wrongly, they expect him to be able to deliver. And remember, I think he paid a second midterm price, two midterms in a row that have been devastating to this president, frankly. He did win re-election in between them by a pretty convincing margin. But I think that he's paying a price, and this will sound harsh to some people, but he did raise our hopes, the country's hopes. He did say Washington would work. He did say he would make it work somehow, that he would find a way to make Democrats and Republicans work together. And I think as Washington has progressively become even more dysfunctional, that people are taking it out on a president that they think has let them down.
Of course it's not all his fault.
But has he made a consistent effort at bipartisanship? No. Have the Republicans made a consistent effort at bipartisanship? Absolutely not. But we do have one president, and they took it to him pretty hard in this election.
Yeah, no one will quarrel with the dysfunction except the 13% who actually think Congress is doing a good job, which I don't quite like to know those 13%. But, you know, what are they so angry at the president about? Unemployment is below 6%. Gas is below $3. The stock market is at record highs. And we were told it was the economy, stupid. Apparently it's not.
How many Democrats did you hear go through the litany you just went through with me during this campaign? They ran. The Democrats literally turned and ran from the things that they could have embraced and been proud of. Now, that's difficult because I will tell you from my travels, and this is growing in every election cycle, we need to give the voters more credit than sometimes we give them, that they have these – people have long-term – even people who've recovered from a financial crisis, even people who didn't get hit all that hard in the financial crisis, who somehow escaped relatively unscathed, have profound long-term questions about what is the American economy going to be in 25 years from now? What is the president of the United States thinking when he looks around the table at this Asian-Pacific meeting it's at right right now. And he looks not just at China and Japan and Korea, but at Singapore and Malaysia and places like that, which, you know, frankly, let's admit it, folks, and shake ourselves, have better education systems than we do, you know, are doing more about the economy than we do in some ways. And so people have long-term profound doubts about the economy that those statistics cannot cure. But when you have Democrats who run single-issue campaigns or run completely defensive in the Crouch campaigns, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. And they were so afraid of embracing the president that they refused to embrace his economic statistics. And yes, he's the president of the United States during what has been an uneven recovery. But if you remember when he took office, and you know what George W. Bush started the bailouts and everything after the financial collapse, and President Obama took it over. Yes, Republicans can poke holes in it. Yes, Republicans can question the role of government and all of that. But Democrats had a pretty good economic story, or at least a down payment economic story, recovery story they could have told. They just ran from it.
Well, you know what's one of the things that always astounds me? I don't know who came up with the great line that about people voting against their self-interest over and over again.
Oh, the guy who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas?
No,
that wasn't Bob Putnam. What was the name of the guy who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas like 2 decades ago? I can't think of his name.
Well, he said it. And, you know, when you talk about the recovery being uneven, of course, in rural areas and outside the big cities, they're still in much worse shape than a lot of the big cities are. Everybody knows that. But one of the big issues is, of course, as people are realizing that wage stagnation, that, you know, the middle class and lower class wages have not kept up with the rich people. There was this great piece in the New York Times today about this rich oil executive who's getting divorced. He's got so much money, he had to give his wife $1 billion in their divorce. So while those people are doing enormously well, the other people aren't. And yet, the people that have been talking about raising wages and income inequality, you're not Republicans. You know what I mean?
I do. And so there's a question, but underneath that is the defining question in our politics today, and that is the role of government. And I tell you, there is increasingly, maybe it's because of the dysfunction and that they can't get anything right, but more and more people you ask, especially in, you know, I grew up in a country where West Virginia was a Democratic state. You know, remember, Michael Dukakis carried West Virginia, one of his 10, back in 1988. Now, if you look at West Virginia and follow the rivers, and you look at, go through Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell won, including a lot of red counties that used to be Democratic counties that Alison Grimes got, you know, smoked in, and that Barack Obama got smoked in, there's a change in what we used to consider blue-collar, Democratic, work-with-your-hands America. And they are increasingly, it's a lot of that area is white, a lot of it is rural, most of it is rural, and it's increasingly Republican. But take away the party label, it is increasingly not the government's job. And whether it's older people in those communities or a lot of younger people you meet, a lot of people looking back at the last 10 or 15 years where they don't think that government can get anything good done have become more anti-government, or maybe it's not anti as much as, you know, forget about it. Just, it's not going to do anything for me. And I think that's part of our politics. I think that's why Republicans are succeeding at many levels, not just we talk a lot about the balance of power in Washington. If you look at how the Republican Party has succeeded in the Obama years at the state level, 31 governors, nearly 1,000 legislative seats have changed hands in the 6-plus years of President Obama, Democrats giving them to Republicans. That's a bench. That's the next generation. Those are future governors, future congressmen, future senators, and probably a future president or two. And underneath it all, Marjorie, are people just thinking, you know, not the government. Get the government out of my way.
You know, John King, what's your prognosis about how these two parties are going to cooperate? One of the great scenes, which I'm sure you've thought about, is when you saw everybody for that little confab at the White House on Friday. These were the unhappiest 15 or 20 people I've ever seen. Harry Reid's staff person is dropping dimes on the president of the United States. The Tea Party people hate the leadership of the Republican Party. They hate the Tea Party people. But some say because the Republicans have to do something on immigration because they want to win the presidency. Some say because Barack Obama is actually more moderate than a lot of his liberal supporters think, that there may be cooperation, not just on things like trade, but on some of the real hot button issues. Where are you on this, John?
I'm hopeful that just as a citizen, that they try. It's not my job to pick the issues, that they try. an infrastructure bank is something the president has talked about for 6 years. Ask Charlie Baker if he'd like some money from Washington to repair roads and bridges and to hire people.
We will.
Yes.
I think he'll start nodding pretty quickly. There are 31 Republican governors out there come January, and for them, some of them would say no, but most of them would not say, let's hire people. Let's repair infrastructure. Let's, build roads to new universities and new high-tech places where we can create new jobs. So I do think they can cooperate on something like that. I think they can cooperate on the trade issues you just talked about, although the president will take some flack from the labor union types if he goes too far in those negotiations. But on the big issues, you name me a big issue, and then we can both go through how it tests both parties' base, not just one party's base. On immigration, the House is not going to act. The president says, I'll give you to the end of the year, and then he's going to do executive action. The House is not going to act because what did they just do? They just ran a campaign in which a lot of those new members and then most of the newly reelected members said, send me back to Washington or send me to Washington for the first time to oppose the president. He wants to be king. He's trying to use executive power. Send me. He wants amnesty. Send me to Washington to stop him. That's what they just campaigned on. They're not going to agree with him on that. And so if he flip that over, if the president decided, okay, I'm going to try to cut a big entitlement deal for my legacy and I'm going to do Medicare and Social Security and some other structural things for the government, how long would it take before Elizabeth Warren is the new Ted Cruz and she's down on the Senate floor saying, over my dead body, we're not going to touch Medicare? So you pick a big issue, and it stokes, where the Republican base might say, sure, we're open to a deal. The Democratic base would say, no way. And vice versa. Does that mean it can't get done? No. But does it mean plus he's going to do immigration first? Remember, he did health care first in 2009, and it polarized Washington, and Republicans refused to lift their heads up and try to work with this president again. If he does immigration right out of the box this time, their base is going to have the same reaction. And so if McConnell and Boehner do have in their DNA deal-making, it's been a while, but they do have it in their DNA. If you go back to prior presidencies over their careers in Washington, they have it in them. But do they have the leash in the Republican Party long enough to cut those deals? I don't know.
John, far be it from me to give advice to either party, but if I were giving advice to the Democratic Party, I would say what I think is both obvious and naive at the same time. You need a new face in Congress. You have a guy who's about to be 75 years old, Harry Reid, on the Senate side. You have Nancy Pelosi, who, despite most people thinking she's responsible for the Affordable Care Act becoming law, 74 years old. Is there even any talk about putting aside a judgment on how well they've done or how poorly they've done, about we just got drubbed for the second midterm in a row, it's time for new leaders? Does anybody have the courage to say that?
There's a lot of talk quietly about that. Is anyone going to publicly rise up and challenge those leaders? Whether it's, looks like Boehner and McConnell are safe. Some people will grumble about it on the Republican side. And it looks like Reid and Pelosi are safe for now. I'm really fascinated by the Pelosi question. Republicans want enough seats that makes it a toss-up at best as to whether, let's assume we don't normally elect the same party after a two-term presidency. George H.W. Bush was the last last person of the same party, elected after a two-term president when he succeeded Ronald Reagan. So history tells you the Republicans should win next time. History also tells you, recent history, that the Republicans have a huge presidential demographic problem. So let's, for the sake of this hypothetical, say that Hillary Clinton or whoever is the Democratic nominee wins next time. Even if that Democratic nominee has pretty big coattails, it's a toss-up now as to whether they would get the House back. That's why Nancy Pelosi's hanging around. She wants to go out as Speaker. She wants to retire as Speaker, not as Minority Leader. Okay, I guess I get it. I mean, look, I've covered these guys for a long time, and this is not to criticize her. They have ego. They have ambition. For the Democrats side, and when you talk to Seth Moulton, ask him about this. Remember, John Tierney was her friend.
Right.
not happy. She was not happy with that primary result, but she will be happy to welcome Seth Moulton to Washington because she's a grown-up. And it'll be interesting to talk to him today and then talk to him in 6 months or 9 months about his relationship with Leader Pelosi, because she's interesting. But she's the only one on the Democratic side that can raise money. So she's a huge fundraiser. Now, Republicans use her to raise money, too. But if she does go away, there's a huge vacuum there. Have they thought about it? Yes. Pelosi herself, I will tell you this, she thought about a year or so ago of negotiating a deal where she, Steny Hoyer, who's the number two, and Jim Clyburn from South Carolina, the number three, all of them in their 60s and 70s, would leave together so that you would not have the current leadership fighting. And the reaction from them, and I'm cutting this down a little bit, so I'm not getting into the nuance, but essentially was to roll their eyes and say, no, you go first. So that didn't happen. So, you know, So she's still here. Welcome to politics.
Yeah.
How much longer can that last? You know, I don't know. Is it healthy for the country? Again, not any of the personalities. We will be pretty soon. The four leaders, both Democrats and Republicans, have been in office, have been the leaders of their parties in the House and the Senate, respectively, for 10 years now. Is that good or is that bad? I guess that would probably be depends who you ask.
Not to mention how long they've all been in Congress. If you add all up the years, we could be over the 100-year mark. I don't know.
I would assume that's true.
You put them all together, but Jim thinks term limits are a terrible idea.
Let's not get into that today,
we'll get into that right now. We're talking with John King, CNN's chief national correspondent. John, what is the status post this election of the Tea Party? I've heard both things, that they're, you know, that they're ready to get together and find out which issue they can shut down the government over, and that on the other side, Republicans are saying, more moderate Republicans saying, enough of this, we do have to make some compromises on something. What's the deal?
We talk about making peace within your family. I think the new Republican leadership, can look back and you can find exceptions to this, but I'll give you an example of Colorado. You know, the Tea Party was not happy there when the establishment not only picked Cory Gardner to be their Senate candidate, but told Ken Buck and another Tea Party challenger to get out of the race, pushed them out of the race, cut off their money and choked their money. The Tea Party was not happy about that at all, and you could have had a situation where they sat on their hands and stayed home, and in a close race, you might have Mark Udall back in Washington. Well, Cory Gardner won. Mitch McConnell survived a Tea Party challenger in Kentucky. Wasn't exactly gentle to the guy in knocking him out of the race. A Tea Party could have stayed home. Mitch McConnell won by a margin much bigger than any of us thought. So I do think that, you know, the challenge for the Republican leadership is to, you know, keep them in the family and make them a little bit happier in the family. The question is, you know, obviously Mitch McConnell's not going to shut down the government, and he's not going to be able to repeal Obamacare. So what happens? Can they be part of a more mature conversation now about where they fit in the party? And can you have a more mature conversation with the leadership saying, look, you know, you're not going to score a touchdown on every play. So what's something in between we can do to show you that we're committed to your principles, but we just simply don't have the math, or we don't agree with you to do something else? That's the conversation. You know, I don't know if the Republicans can have that because it is a combustible, volatile group. In some places, they're strong. In some places, this campaign was humbling to them. A lot of them got beat in the primaries, remember. So I think you're going to see different reactions in different places. In the United States Senate, you're going to see Ted Cruz. You know those two little, you know, the old movies where the two little voices pop up on your shoulders, the good voice and the bad voice? Ted Cruz is going to be that voice for Mitch McConnell every time he tries to do anything. Be confrontational, and we'll see how it plays out. I think the next 6 months of the Ted Cruz for president campaign will tell you a lot about, is there enough support out there in the country for that kind of tactic and strategy? Is the Tea Party big enough to make that a presence, or does it become a nuisance? But it's not going away.
You know, John, the thing I've been worked into a frenzy about for the last month, pre-election and now post-election, is the fact that Congress was home fundraising and running for office while we are engaging, at least in my opinion, in yet another war in Iraq and Syria. And the only thing that rose to almost that level of upset for me is that the president announced the doubling of the number of military advisors in Iraq on the Friday after the election. Obviously, the concern that it may have an impact couldn't have been much worse for the Democrats than it was. What's the feedback, both Republican and Democratic? I know it's not monolithic on this, on the potential of that overused expression, mission creep here with these extra 1,500 people.
I think that conversation is very real. I saw John McCain on CNN air this morning saying it reminds him a lot of Vietnam, that, you know, because you're afraid of the politics, you do, you know, a couple hundred here, then 1,500 there, and what are you going to do next? And then, you know, 6 months or 9 months, you look back, and it's like, whoa, that's a pretty big number. Where'd that come from? Now, he's a critic of the president, so process that through that, you know, through that critical filter. But I do think announcing it the Friday after the election had a lot of people in Washington rolling their eyes. Did you hold it for political reasons? And I do think that people are concerned. People who think that you need more boots on the ground are concerned, and people who think, wait a minute, this is not, I thought this was going to be, you know, just advisors. You're going to talk to a guy who knows a lot more about this than we do in a few minutes, and so you should ask him about this. But, you know, it is crystal clear that the decade and the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more than that, I don't know the final number, spent training the Iraqi army, at least those who are in the Iraqi army today. We could call it a waste. We could call it a failure. I don't know what to call it. But they're not ready to fight for their own country. That just happens to be a fact. And the question then is the debate, what is the United States, what is the responsibility of the United States in that environment? A, to Iraq, the country, and B, to combating ISIS so that it can't spread even further. And the country's going to have this conversation. And hopefully with the campaign behind us, we can have it in a more logical, rational, thoughtful way. I do think that you're going to see, I saw Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who said this before the election, I want to have a vote. But we cannot, you know, he thinks it's a charade. And I think increasingly in Washington, Democrats and Republicans think it's ridiculous to say that President Obama has this authority because of the, you know, authorization of force that George W. Bush used to go to war in Iraq. I think if you're going to have this, you know, 10 years later in a new administration under new circumstances, because this isn't about Saddam Hussein, this is about ISIS, that you need to have a new debate and a new vote. And I do think that is one thing you will see in the new Congress. And whatever your position is out there, I actually think if they air that out and have a debate, it'll be good for the country. A, to get the attention of people who aren't paying it. A lot of people aren't paying attention to this. And I don't think they understand the long-term risks of this. And that'll be a good thing for the country. And not my job to say, you know, vote yay, vote nay. But I do think to focus the American people on what is this challenge again and how real is this, and wait, even this president, you know, this president says it's going to take a decade. That means the next president's going to be dealing with it, and maybe the one after that. So I think a good debate, I'm sorry we're in this mess. I wish we weren't. But I think a good debate about it is necessary.
You know, John King, one last question for me. Charles Blow had a column a couple of days ago in the New York Times. He's a black guy, and he was talking about Obama, the Obama opposition. And he was basically saying that part of what this wrath against Obama is not about what he did, but who he is, meaning he is also a black guy, and that his just very presence in Washington to certain people was a less a salve than a thorn in their side, and that what he's basically saying, there's a racism going on here, that sub rosa that people don't want to talk about, and that the vehemence of the opposition to him is partly that. What do you think of that?
I think some of that, without a doubt, is true. I've tried for 6 years to try to quantify how big of the opposition pie, you know, if you take a pie and that's the opposition to Obama, how big of a slice is just plain racism and nothing else. And I've always tried to, you know, convince myself that it's a pretty small slice. And I believe it's a pretty small slice. You pick it up when you travel. There are some people who just viscerally react to him and you say why, and they don't have much of an answer for you. Now, I do want to say, you know, some people say because they didn't like the health care plan, they think it's too much government, that they don't like the way he's handling foreign policy, they don't think he's decisive. So there are a lot of people out there, let's not, you know, label everybody, there are a lot of people out there who disagree with him philosophically and ideologically or temperamentally. A lot of people who voted for him now are disappointed in him. But yes, is there a slice of this that is racism? Absolutely. And anyone who denies that is blind. Just blind. Is it bigger in different places? Does it ebb and flow as things go on? Yes, it's part of it. And I try to talk to African Americans about this to get their perspective on it. And some of them, you know, begrudgingly say that it was almost inevitable that you kind of have this historic moment. And so then the ugly stuff is going to come out when you have that historic moment. And their hope is that, you know, as time passes, that people process it better and it makes it, quote unquote, easier, you know, for the next African-American leader, whether it be a man or a woman or a president or somewhere else. I don't know. But is Charles right that there's a slice of it out there? Absolutely. And to deny that is to just deny that we breathe oxygen.
You know, before you go away, Anderson Cooper is the guy that does your nighttime show. I know you know over there at CNN. He had something to say the other night. I just wanted your quick reaction to, John. Here it is.
Simply put, if you ever have a chance to get John King on your bar trivia team, grab him. If there are any questions about geography, math, or whether the voters in some small county in Montana are typically morning people or night people, he will know the answer. John King is the quarterback of the esoteric knowledge of counties team, and election night is his Super Bowl.
Now, we were going to play the whole thing, but we only have a 3-hour show, so we couldn't do it. You were sitting there for that. What was your reaction to those incredibly kind and, I think, accurate words from Cooper?
He was having fun with his ridiculous at my...
No, he was not.
It was both funny and a compliment. Look, I'm lucky to do what I do, and I get to travel. And my bosses don't like me around, so they kick me out of the office, which is a good thing. I love that part of elections. I've said this to you guys 100 times, you cannot understand America sitting in Washington, because Washington is not America. It's only through traveling you learn the marvelous diversity and craziness of the country. And I say craziness with a big smile on my face in a happy way. I do this for a reason. I love what I do, and I love getting out in the country. And it was a nice compliment from Anderson, but he's also trying to have a little fun with me.
And by the way, I learned from you, the smallest county in the United States, what is it, 25 people in Texas or something?
Loving County, Texas. They're approaching 100. They're
okay,
up there somewhere in the 90s now.
Okay. Hey, John, it's great to talk to you. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. Thanks for your time.
Take care, guys.
John King is CNN's chief national correspondent and the host of Inside Politics. He joins us every Tuesday. Coming up, boots on the ground. President Obama will send 1,500 more troops to Iraq. Is this the beginning of the end of the Islamic State or the beginning of another war in the region? We're asking you next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Gaines. Literally doubling down on his push to stamp out the Islamic State fighters, President Obama announced on Friday after the elections that he's authorized the deployment of an additional 1,500 American troops to Iraq. Today, Vice President Joe Biden will lay a wreath at the Arlington National Cemetery at the Tomb of the Unknowns. As part of our Veterans Day coverage, we spoke to Congressman-elect Seth Moulton. We'll be playing his entire interview in the next hour. But here's what he had to say about the president's decision to send more ground troops into Iraq.
The problem with sending more U.S. troops into an advisory role is that I know from my own experience that being a military advisor can very quickly turn into a ground combat role. That was actually my mission with my Marine platoon on my second deployment in 2004, just 10 years ago. We were military advisors in Iraq, and when the Iraqi unit that we were assigned to mentor and work with started to get overrun by the militia in Najaf, that started the Battle of Najaf. We went to their assistance, and it was the worst ground combat of the war until that time. So a military advisory mission can very quickly become a ground combat mission. I mean, let's not forget, the Vietnam War started as a military advisory mission.
Let's not forget the Vietnam War, Seth Moulton said, started as a military advisory mission. So we want to know, how do you feel about the doubling of the number of U.S. soldiers being sent to Iraq? Do you see this as the start of another war? Or are you comfortable with the president's decision? Our number is 877-301-8970. Moulton, as John King said, Moulton knows much more about this than all of us.
Yep.
His concern, in my opinion, should be everybody's concern. Mission creep, the lessons of Vietnam. If this was a policy the president thought was as solid as the sending of troops would suggest, he wouldn't have announced it on the Friday after an election. He would have announced it on the Friday or the Friday before that, before the election. But he understood this is not, I think, wildly popular, nor understood by the American people. And I have to say, I'm one of the people who doesn't understand why we're doing this. I'm with Moulton on this thing.
Well, you hear obviously both sides of this. You hear also a lot of people clamoring for our getting more involved over there because ISIS is this the horrible, evil, on-the-move, growing menace that we have to root out at its base. And I get that. I'm just not sure why we're the ones who always have to do the rooting out. I mean, it gets back to what Moulton alluded to, too. Where's the Iraqi army here?
Well, the quote you always use from the New York Times, they're not, quote, motivated to be fighting. The million Iraqi soldiers whom we trained
but
are not
seems,
motivated to
but
fight.
But it does seem that when you have ISIS at your doorstep, that's a great motivator. And again, we're the ones leading everything. We're the ones leading the airstrikes. We're the ones that are going to be leading the troops on the ground. We're the ones that are putting our young men and women over there. And, you know, there's a big country there. And I guess I don't get why we always have to be in first.
Well, in first and in second and in third. And by the way, my understanding of this doubling of the so-called military advisors is they are in much greater proximity to combat than their predecessors several months ago, which raises the risk as well. So we want to know what you think about this. One, do you think the president made the right move? Two, are you concerned, as I am, as I just said to John King, and I know I've been saying every day, that Congress actually might want to go do their job and have a debate about this, whether they should authorize the action or not. You can have a debate over. It's hard for me to have a debate over whether or not they should be in Washington actually talking about this. It seems to me that's what we pay them for. So what's your reaction to this whole thing? And by the way, I really hate the fact. I understand it totally. I hate the fact this was done Friday after an election. This is a monumental, potentially a monumental decision with huge implications for this country, its people, the families of these very few people who make these great sacrifices. And I think they're owed more, and I think the American people are owed more.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Our email is bpr@wgbhnews.org. I think I got that right, bpr@wgbhnews.org. And the question is, how do you feel about this deployment of 1,500 more troops to Iraq? Do we have to go in? Are we needed to rescue the situation over there? Or should we not be going in? Or should Congress be back so we can all have a big debate about whether
No one can disagree. Does anybody disagree with that, by the way? I mean, you can disagree over whether they have to authorize the president's actions. There's a dispute about who argues that Congress should not be there when we're committing United States troops into a foreign country at war?
Well, I know it obviously is one of your chief obsessions. And if, even for those of us who aren't obsessed, you certainly would like to have some kind of a debate about this, hear all the pros and cons, and have an opportunity to get hear everybody talk about this and have a more of an opportunity for Congress people to have to stick their necks out. Excuse me.
Well, it's not just that. It's what John King said. If there were two sides of the debate being heard every night on the evening news, every day on Boston Public Radio and beyond, then the American people would be more engaged. That 1,500 people, unless you know them or are the family, it's like an abstract concept. It's not real. And I would argue this is totally real. Let's start in Braintree with Sam. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for making it.
I am confident that as a shareholder in the Raytheon Company, our president will make the right decision for our shareholders. And I think that the important thing, without being flipped, is that, and I mean this with all sincerity, mm-hmm. I seldom agree with Charlie Rangel, but on one thing I do, and it is essential to reinstate the draft. Nothing will change until we reinstate the draft. You're right, it only involves 1,500 people. The only way to change that, the only way, is to reinstate the draft. I'm 1,000% in favor of it, and you're talking to someone who has a son who's going to turn 18 in 2 months.
Well, wow, you're a brave dad, Sam.
Well, you also beat us to the punch. In a couple of minutes, Sam, we're going to raise that very topic and play for you. In fact, we'll do it now. Here's Democratic Congressman, as you mentioned, Charlie Rangel from Harlem. This is in February of last year, 2013, after he introduced yet again his latest bill to reinstate the draft.
Well, the Congress never gets a chance to vote up and down on these war questions. Every president just puts our kids in harm's way, and we just foot the bill. But there's no real sacrifice in what's going on. Less than 1% of American families are involved in the military, and they really pay the price for it. And the Congress sits back and just allows these things to happen. Take my word for it. If every time a president was about to put our kids in harm's way, we were thinking about our kids and our grandkids, it just wouldn't happen.
By the way, he has never spoken more truth in his life. Sam, thank you for the suggestion and the call. I don't think that Charlie Rangel really wants there to be a draft. I think Charlie Rangel's point is we wouldn't be so cavalier with a commitment of money and human power to these conflicts
not.
If it could be the sons and daughters of members of Congress and key constituents. You know what I also didn't realize until today? You know, when you're 18 years old and you're a young man,
right,
you have to register with Selective Service, even though there isn't a draft. And if you don't, you lose your eligibility for college loans, those sort of things, federal jobs. You know who doesn't need to register for the Selective Service?
Young women.
Women, even though they are now allowed in combat. What is the – and by the way, that's in the bill that he filed in 2013. So we have two things on the table, thanks to our caller. I think it was Sam. One, what do you think about the president's decision announced on a Friday to double the number of so-called military advisors in Iraq? And two, what do you think of Charlie Rangel's idea and Sam's that we reinstitute the draft so that there is shared sacrifice when sacrifice needs to be made?
Let's go to John in Shrewsbury. Hi, John.
Hey, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I don't want to take much I don't want to take too much of your time, but I'd like to, I think this discussion about authorization is proceeding in a historical vacuum here.
Hey, John, we got to put you on hold 1 second. You have a horrible cell connection. We'll take one call, and we'll try you one more time immediately after that, so don't go away. I'm sorry. Dan, you're in Reading. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Dan.
Hi. Well, you were talking about the giraffe. I really think, you know, it's kind of, you know, I understand where Rangel's coming from, and it will force that into the, you know, conscious American people's consciousness, but it's a hell of a way to do it, and I wish that it could happen in a different way. But getting back to, you know, the concern about our troops on the ground, I think you have to decide what our military is for. I mean, we did fight, you know, a fairly, you know, the first Iraq war, you know, Desert Storm worked. But if you're going to go into a country and try and change, you know, the internal structure and not even have the support, you know, of the people, I don't think it's ever going to work. You're going to get into a quagmire, as what is happening now in Afghanistan. You really cannot, you know, change, you know, you can't remake a country. It never will work.
Well, there were some great op-eds in the Boston Globe, New York Times, Washington Post in the last year talking about how that old notion that the West can impose its small-d democratic will on places that haven't made that decision for themselves. Time and again, history suggests you're right, that it just can't happen. So where do you end up on this whole thing vis-a-vis what the president's doing, Dan?
When it goes back to, you know, how far it's going to go, and I do think that at some point, there has to be, you know, a line where you authorization, you know, is required, you know, through Congress. That, you know,
I think that's what John, who had the horrible connection, was trying to say. That I have to say, I agree with you, and I think John King, while he didn't take sides, made the point relying on authorization that had to do with Saddam Hussein from more than 10 years ago is borderline preposterous. And the president seemed to be saying the other day, I think the day after the election, I hope I have the day right, I'm not sure, maybe it was Bob Schieffer on Sunday, he seemed to be saying that he now did want congressional authorization, but I don't know if he ever went so far as to say that without it, he doesn't have the power to proceed. I don't think he's that far there yet.
We're getting some emails on this. Linda from New Hampshire is singing your tune, Jim. She says, Congress will play games and people won't care, won't pay attention or educate themselves until their kids might go. And, you know, she makes a very good point. I mean, we go back to that classic line from our buddy Mike Barnicle that talked about people not having any skin in the game.
Skin in the game, right.
And that's a big deal. I mean, a lot of us remember back to Vietnam. If you were worried about going, you were worried about your kid going, you were worried about your brother going or your father going. It changed everything very quickly.
Don't you think that's what ended the war?
Of course it's what ended the war, because the middle class parents got upset about this and said enough is enough is enough. And people are not engaged, obviously, the way we should be in this whole thing right now.
If there was a draft, would Congress be in session right now?
Yes.
Of course they would. How could they possibly explain to a constituent that we're out vacationing and raising money?
I'd also think we'd look at these whole things differently. I think we would say, okay, what is our strategy toward ISIS? Do we go over there and fight them? Do we fortify our border so they can't come here? I mean, Boko Haram just blew up a school and killed 50 kids and injured another 80. We're going to go over to Nigeria now and go after Boko Haram because they haven't found the 300 girls that they kidnapped months ago? I mean, what is our foreign policy? I mean, are we going to be the policemen of the world or are we not?
I think it's a great point. And I would bet if you, regardless of where people are on those issues, I would bet that if you stopped 100 people in the street with a representative sampling from all political parties, all political persuasions from all over the country, none of them could answer that question. What exactly is our philosophy of involvement across our borders?
Well,
I don't know what it is either.
I think we did have one for a while after Vietnam, which is that we shouldn't. I mean, why do we go to Vietnam? We went to Vietnam to stop the spread of communism. Well, we decided at some point that that wasn't a good idea and we were going to come back. We're not going into Ukraine. I mean, it's
well, theoretically, it's an imminent threat to our own security. And if you remember, the weekend that it was announced, I hope I get my time right, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the weekend that it was announced that we were going to start the bombing of ISIS, what also happened that week? We were told about a group that most of us had never heard about until we read about them in the Sunday New York Times the prior day.
Oh, that
Khorasan.
Yeah.
What have we heard about Khorasan?
Yeah, they disappeared.
And the reason that they were included in that mix is because it was more credible to suggest that they were a threat to the United States as opposed to the Islamic State, so that the American people, in my estimation, would buy into this whole notion that we were about to get involved.
But again, what we view as a threat seems to be in flux all the time, because for a long time, we didn't think the Nazis were a threat. A lot of people didn't want to go into World War II, and we had different ideas about the communist threat. So I don't know. It's very confusing and very upsetting, and I have no answers.
Let's take another call, then we'll take a break, and then we'll continue this discussion. Where do you want to go?
Michael in the car. Thank you for calling, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Yes, hello. This is my second time calling. I called once before under "What's your gripe with the governor?" And this time, it's more concerning to me. I do agree that we would need a draft in this country, because that would get everybody's attention when we go into these military conflicts, but only with complete transparency. Because what happened back then in the draft is any wealthy or privileged families were able to get their kids out.
Very good point.
The only way we could initiate a fair draft is to have complete transparency, so that one of these, when Congress or senators, House or Senate members' kids get out of it, we know exactly who they are, and we can point the finger at them. Now, as far as them not weighing in on this military action, which, by the way, is kind of like whack-a-mole over there. We whack one mole down and another one springs up. And my opinion on the conflict over there, it's all to keep the military-industrial complex going. I mean, if you go back in history and figure out what happened to initiate this whole terrorist act, and it's the terrorists of the day, like you said, Khorasan and ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Taliban. It's like, oh, which one is it today? Well, it's all one and the same. Basically, the military-industrial conflict wants something over there so that all of our money can go over there and supply the defense contractors with billions of dollars. Look at what happened in the first Iraq war, Halliburton with no-bid contracts.
We can go beyond Halliburton. Who was the president leaving office more than a half century ago that came from the military-industrial complex?
Eisenhower, right.
Eisenhower, exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, Michael, that was a great call.
We are over 50 years later, and it's much worse.
Well, we had the
Michael, thanks for the call.
Call it made the joke about the shareholders
Raytheon,
of
Raytheon.
I don't know if he was joking or not. Anyway, we're going to keep this conversation going about how you feel about more soldiers being sent to Iraq. How do you feel about the draft being reinstituted in the United States? The military isn't crazy about it. We can discuss that, too. If you've been deployed to Iraq, is this our only option? 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brush. She is Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're marking Veterans Day in a couple of ways. In a little while, in the 12 o'clock hour, we'll talk to Seth Moulton, four times deployed into Iraq, recently elected to Congress from the North Shore. We're also looking at President Obama's decision announced on Friday to send double, actually, the number of troops, 1,500 more military advisors, as they're called, to Iraq. We also played some sound from Charles Rangel, who every couple of years, he's a congressperson from Harlem in New York City, proposes a draft. We played sound from what he said when he filed the most recent version of that bill in February 20 of 13. Well, he was speaking to journalist Molly Hooper more recently, this past September, in fact, about his thoughts on the fight against ISIS and the potential of that draft.
If this new threat is so serious, let us say that in order for the president to have the authority for us to put our young people in harm's way, then we have to be prepared to say that service sacrifice is demanded.
That's Charles Rangel. I think if you were to administer sodium pentothal, he would say it has absolutely no chance of passing. But he's filed that bill to make a point. I think he's made the point quite well.
Amina just sent us an email saying that you could probably do a draft that's one person per state per month, and even that would make a difference. Imagine that. If you had 10 people from Massachusetts going every month, and one of them had a real sob story, you know, you could tell that person's sob story, the TV stations, the newspapers would cover it, and that would get everybody's blood.
It would connect to real people.
Connect
to, there's no connection to the vast. You know what I learned last night,
like
by the way?
The Hunger Games.
Do you know that we've had Carlos Arredondo and his wife, Melibel, on the show? Do you know what she tweeted me last night, which I confirmed with Seth Moulton on TV before we went on the air? Carlos's first son, who, you know, was killed in Iraq, served with Seth Moulton together. They were friends. I think on Seth's first, Congressman-elect Moulton's first, nor did I until she mentioned it, and I wasn't sure what she meant. Alex was his name, and Seth confirmed it and spoke lovingly and of his former comrade.
And he, of course, is the man that we all saw the picture of in the cowboy hat, pushing the wheelchair down the street.
Jeff Bowman. And by the way, who was a peace activist extraordinaire with his wife for ages, long before he became an international story. 877-301-8970. How do you feel about the doubling of so-called military advisors announced Friday? And what do you think of Charlie Rangel, Congressman Charles Rangel's position that maybe what we need is a draft?
We're going to try again. John in Shrewsbury, thank you for being patient.
Hi, John.
No, I'm sorry for the bad connection, but I wanted to say that I felt that this conversation is going on in a bit of a vacuum, I think, a historical vacuum, recent history. First of all, to go to the Bush-era authorization and whether that would provide legal justification, well, we have to consider that that authorization should have never been provided and should have no force because we were lied into that war. There are no weapons of mass destruction, nor did Iraq have any connection to 9/11. That was a big lie. So it seems to me that without recalling that, we're going nowhere.
I don't think, John, obviously in the spirit of fairness, there's some people who don't think it was a lie. They think it was a horrible mistake. But putting that aside for a second, I don't think you have to, it's fine to revisit history. I don't think you need to revisit history. I think it strains credibility for anybody to suggest that authorization, even if it was well-intended, in any way covers what the United States is proposing to do now. But go ahead, John.
Give you that, although it's really you. I don't know. In any court of law, I think, well, we won't go into that. In any event, it was a war that shouldn't have been waged. In my view, it was based on lies. That's number one. Now, number two, giving Obama power, authorizing him to wage war, that's not what we should be doing. He waged war, bombed a country, a sovereign country, Libya, without congressional authorization. We should be talking about impeaching him for that, not giving him more authority. That is really, not to consider that is a little bit crazy. And the third thing, just as today is a day we're hearing a lot of sob stories on NPR about our great veterans. And yes, they were victimized and some of them hurt. But we never, never hear one of those stories about the hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, that have been killed by us over there in unjust wars.
John, I couldn't disagree with you more. I have heard. John, can I? You've gone on, and I would like to actually get a word in, if you don't mind. NPR has done brilliant stories about civilian casualties in Iraq on a fairly regular basis. So, with all due respect, John, and thank you for your call. I think it's selective listening. I appreciate your passion about the thing, and I share much of the belief that you do. But I think NPR, not just NPR, I think most serious news stations have been fairly responsible, even though it is true to say we have focused more on our own and the 4,500 thereabouts who were killed in Iraq than the tens of thousands of civilians who were killed in Iraq by us and our allies.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking about whether there should be a draft or not. You know what? If I were going to do the draft, if I were like the Tsarina, I would say you get a choice. You either go into the military or you do public service, and you have 2 years of service to your country. And
let the individual choose?
Yes. It
takes
one
all the
other
pressure, even though I believe in that, because we've discussed civilian mandatory service a lot.
Yeah, you do a city-year type thing that one of your
kids
did.
Yeah, but you know what the answer is? Then all the pressure is off on the American people, because as soon as they're convinced that their son or daughter is going to choose civilian service safe at home rather than military service, then the pressure is off these pitiful souls in Congress, who basically are only going to be pushed if the middle class is worried that their kids, people like Seth Moulton, by the way, Seth Moulton is an atypical volunteer.
Maybe you modify it then, say, instead of going back for your third and fourth tour of duty, which is another, you know, we talk about the greatest generation in World War II, and they were a great generation. Dan Johns got a great piece about his dad on the front page of the paper today.
It was great.
But, you know, when you went to Vietnam, you weren't going to Vietnam, and World War II was, of course, the greatest generation, but you weren't going for over and over and over again. And Seth Moulton, we'll talk about that when we talked about to him later about how thinking he was done, then you're not done, you're going back again. So maybe the thing is to go after the people that are at City Air before they send somebody back for a second or third time to do another tour of duty. Anyway, Steve from Freetown, what do you think, Steve?
Good morning, everyone. I have to tell you, right off the bat,
I'm sick to death. I do believe in mission creep, and I'm sick to death of fighting wars of our soldiers picking up their weapons and defending other countries that don't want to be defended. Listen, I'm a Republican. I'll tell you. I'll be the first one to tell you. We screwed up in Iraq. Republicans, whether you want to admit it or not, you need to own up to that, because we were behind that 100%. But in saying that, I think that too many times as somebody who came from a military family, who all his uncles, and I think most of us did because of the draft, you know, served, I would be, I have to tell you that they say the worst thing about going to war under false pretenses is going into war and not going in to win it. And that's what happened in Vietnam. And unfortunately, I think if we go back in and send our soldiers into something like this, you know, we're going to fall right back into that again, because we really don't fight wars to win them, especially when they're not really important wars. And that's why I say I think we need to keep our nose out of it. Unfortunately, you know, some people aren't going to like what I have to say next, but my eyes is basically like Rand Paul. Look, we'll leave you alone. You leave us alone, but if you come and bother us, we're going to wipe you right out. And I know innocent people will be killed, but at least we know in our hearts that we did everything we could to keep our nose out of other people's business, keep our country safe, and, you know, you let the cards fall where they will. Because I got to tell you, Jim and Marjorie, every Veterans Day, I wake up in the morning and I get angry on this day. And I get angry at myself because, once again, it reminded me, even though I do some things for the veterans, I don't do enough. And I hear everybody, all these people, all of us, and I'm just as guilty. Oh, look what we're doing for the veterans, okay? And, yeah, where are we the other 364 days a year? And I'm probably one of the most guilty people about it.
You know, Steve, let me sign up for the same list. And, Steve, thank you for the call. Do you remember the line during the Iraq War from those of us who opposed the war? We oppose the war, but we support the troops. Whatever that meant. That was almost
the
mantra. Exactly.
Obviously.
We don't support the troops. For the most part, Congress doesn't support the troops until there's some expose, like CNN's expose on what happened, even though it was overblown to a degree in Phoenix, the story in the Washington Post about Walter Reed. The reality is it is rhetoric. And that's why I think it's important at the end of the day that people have actually fought in recent wars like Moulton. Are there to be part of the debate.
Well, speaking of Moulton, we're going to be talking to Seth Moulton just a little bit later on the show about sending the troops over there, about what he thinks should be done, what he will do as a newly elected congressman from the 6th District. That's all coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
General Manager of the T, Beverly Scott, kicks off hour two of today's Boston Public Radio. We'll discuss more subway cars and buses, more rider-friendly alerts, but less money to pay for it all. Then Congressman-elect and Iraq War veteran Seth Moulton joins us on Veterans Day to discuss doubling U.S. troop commitment in Iraq and what his agenda for veterans will be in D.C.
Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on millennials who are quitting jobs without another one to go to. Are you one of those millennials? Are you the parents of one? We're going to ask you. You're nervous about that? Then WGBH Arts Editor Jared Bowen on the latest in film, theater, and movies all around town. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
We'll be right back.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hello there, Marjorie. And we are joined in Studio 3 by actually one of our favorite guests. I shouldn't disclose that fact. Take our questions and yours. She is the MBTA General Manager. That would be Beverly Scott. Hello, Beverly. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
Excellent.
Very good. Yeah. Very good to see you. Well, Jim just said you're one of our favorite guests, and you indeed are. So I just want to make sure you're going to be continue to be one of our favorite guests. We have a new Republican governor. You hanging around. I know you got a contract through 2015, but what's the deal?
Do you know what? I definitely am going to transition with the transition with this team, and then I wish this governor all the best. We're going to give him everything that we can to be supportive, and we'll see.
We'll see. Okay.
Yeah. I am embarrassed to say I don't know. When someone does what you do, is it typical that a new transportation secretary would say, listen, she's running something and she's doing a good job, so we're content with her, or that you would be told to fly away?
Do you know what? I have found, now, and since I am a person whose teams, okay, I've worked in quite a number, I find that people usually get a little bit more hyper about that than they should, okay? Most of the time, if things are running well, I find that people are really, you know, good public servants, and they, you know, why mess with it if it's not broken? At the same time, I tell you the honest to God's truth, I think that alignment is absolutely critical, so I never have any confusion in my mind, okay, that the individual who's the chief executive officer should always have the ability to be able to select the people that they want to be their team.
Do you know Baker, by the way?
I've not even met him personally. I've seen him in a couple of meetings, and he comported himself very well.
Okay, so on the same day that Charlie Baker was elected, the inflation adjustment, the automatic inflation adjustment on the gas tax was defeated. Most estimates suggest that takes away $1 billion over the next 10 years for transportation infrastructure. A piece of that billion is you. What does that mean in real terms for plans you have for new cars, new buses, rehabilitation, new stations like this Blue Hill Ave station that's being celebrated for 2017?
Yeah, what I tell you is that there's no way that you can wind up having $1 billion come off of the table, and that does not make a major difference. At the same time, we moved forward very aggressively as soon as the transportation finance legislation, all of that was passed. So a number of the big projects for us are literally booked and under contract at this point in time. Okay, so for example, you know, we wound up changing, we did everything we needed to do on the commuter rail side. We wound up, the Orange and Red Line cars, we have buses, all of that. But there is going to have to be an adjustment. And at this point in time, the only thing I can tell you is that there has not been any selection of projects, if you will. And quite candidly, that will be one of the challenges that we'll all be working with this new governor on. But it's, make no mistake, you said it, it's $1 billion off. That is absolutely with a B. That's absolutely significant. I cannot tell you down at the line of which projects, but something's going to have to give.
But just so I'm clear, you say certain things are in the pipeline, but we're going to talk to you in a minute about all these new cars, these hybrid buses. Again, you and the governor talked about and Transportation Secretary Davey, this new Blue Hill Ave station, I think, in 2017.
Right.
Are any of those things potentially at risk, or is the money there to pay for them?
The money is there to pay for those, okay? And once again, as I've said, unless we're literally going to go and basically stop projects or move things that have actually been on there for years out of the capital program. But there's going to have to wind up being some selection of what are going to be some projects that are forthcoming that just aren't going to happen.
So I'm misunderstanding or not understanding that the money's there for the projects that Jim just mentioned, but
the contracts. So those things
for which
we have actually executed contracts.
Okay.
So unless we were going to go and award it, we've actually done the awards. Okay. So that's now in the case of the Blue Hill Ave station. All of the design work has, you know, been underway for some time. That's roughly about $20 million that's in the budget for a future construction contract.
Okay.
So could a Blue Hill Avenue station go? Could something wind up happening with any number of not only transit projects, but highway projects? Not only could, it's going to. Okay. And so, but which ones those will wind up being, I can't tell you.
We're talking to Beverly Scott, who is the head of the MBTA, general manager, I should say, of the MBTA. You know, Bev, there were a lot of complaints. Rival bidders, human rights advocates complained about this Chinese rail car manufacturer Center that got this contract to supply the AT with 284 new Red Line and Orange Line cars. This is just a few weeks ago. They're going to be assembled in Springfield, however. So what was your answer to the people that were complaining about this?
My answer was that we wound up getting, number one, this rail car manufacturer is the largest rail car manufacturer in the world, okay? We happen to be, I think, quite fortunate at this point in time because of the fact that we wound up with an absolutely terrific deal on these rail cars. And you only wind up being able to get this, I think, really one time because not only do we have the rail cars, but we had a Make It in Massachusetts requirement. And they are actually setting up their North American manufacturing facility in Springfield. It will be a 150,000 square foot minimum facility, which they are putting $60 million in themselves in order to be able to bring up. Okay, so this is the first time that this manufacturer has actually come into North America, and we were just really quite fortunate. And the fortunate part was, once again, I'm going to come back to where you asked the question originally about the transportation legislation. If there had been no transportation legislation, we would not have been in a position to wind up being able to move forward to do the replacement on the Orange and Red Line cars. I will remind everyone, the Red Line cars that we will be replacing are 44 years old, okay? I mean, not like they don't need it. And we just wouldn't have been able to get out there in the marketplace and happen to hit at just the right time as this major manufacturer was looking to make the entry into the North American market. So we were very, very fortunate. And we would not have been able to do the Make It in Massachusetts content if we had not done it with local funding, because if we had tried to do that with only federal dollars, we would not have been able to require having that final assembly work take place.
So the bottom
here.
Line, these Chinese rail cars were more affordable and
absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And we were there at the right place at the right time. And quite candidly, that's the kind of window that opens up one time. And we were, because of all the confidence and the funding, we were able to move forward to take advantage of
it. But my understanding is there was some investigation of these human rights allegations against them. Yes? Or was there?
Yeah, there were.
And?
Okay. This is what I will tell you. There was nothing. We complied with every single requirement in terms of who can, who could not bid on the project. Every single one, it's unfortunate, but there are not U.S. manufacturers that could wind up doing rail cars.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that when I read it. Nobody in the United States manufactures train cars, subway cars.
At this kind of, you got little onesies and twosies kind of thing, but nobody, okay? So this
Why?
Is,
Why?
Well, this is because what's wound up happening to us in America over the last, 30, 40-year period of time. And that's one of the things that hopefully we'll be able to start being able to reverse. We have gotten out of making things.
Well, in part, but also in fairness, the Chinese government helps subsidize these companies. The United States government is not about to subsidize rail manufacturers.
Well, I thought you were also going to say
the Chinese government is subsidizing there, the French. I've been saying, so just about everybody who wound up applying for, bidding on this, every single one of them is from out of the country, and many of them, whether it was the South Koreans, whether we were talking about the French, whether we're talking about the Germans or whatever, just about every one of those in those markets, yes, you find that there is, in fact, some ownership of those companies some portion of that ownership that's by their countries.
Well, I thought you were going to say not just that we've stopped making things, which I suppose many people would argue we have, but also that we're not reinvesting.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a little off topic, but I am curious, since you are in this business. Even if you go to, I was just in New York City, and the New York City subways are kind of old too, but they are really fast, and you're always struck by how old and decrepit the whole system here is in Boston, and it's kind of like it's never going to get fixed. We're just going to be squeaking around the corner at Boylston Street with that huge.
Oh, Marjorie, this is the one. Beverly Scott.
Yes.
This is all Marjorie is obsessed with is the squeaking as it turns at Boylston Street.
But what you'd have to dig up the whole thing and start all over again.
You said they're buying hundreds of new cars.
Yeah,
you said it a minute ago, the hybrid buses.
But the system itself. The system itself is very old.
But Marjorie, I'll tell you now, I worked in New York for 6 years. I know that everybody would appreciate what you just said, but they'd be telling you, oh, I went to Nordstrom Avenue and it was like this. And it's a fascinating. I just was talking to some folks last week, And these are, they're not from here.
Yeah.
And they were just unabashedly, the gym, it's no question, we're old. And I, you know, I say the whole thing, you know, we're like fine wine, it's true. But I tell you, this system is unbelievable, and people from all over the world. But they come and say, oh, you know, we wish we had transit service like you guys have the service. They drive every place they at home. They drive everywhere. When they come here, they don't even think about it. They use the T. They're on the service. And so now we got to care for, okay, because the system is, you know, it's got to, you know, it's old and all of that. But that's why these reinvestments are absolutely critical. And when you see, look at what's taking place on the blue line. Look, the orange, we're going to not only replace all the orange line cars, we're actually, we have 120, we're adding 30 cars, which means we're going to be able to take the headways down. Yep. You know, the frequency levels will wind up being able to go down to about four and a half minutes from where we are with 6 minutes now. We're, because of the fact that we got such a competitive order on this one, we were only originally going to replace one set of the red line cars, but now we're actually going to be able to have the funding that would permit us to be able to exercise an option at a competitive price, which will get rid of pretty much about 60% of them will be able to wind up doing with replacement.
But just one last thing when I get off, I'll get off this jag.
Marjorie wants you to go to the legislature and say, can you raise taxes so we can straighten out the line going into the Boylston Street Station?
Well, that is only one of the one of the few curved ones, right? But I guess my question is this. The basic infrastructure with the tracks and the tunnels and all that, we're not behind in other places. That's a mistake on my part.
Oh, no, it's not a mistake. Okay, we are. If we have state of good repair needs that are up the gazoo. Okay, however, in that regard, we're not behind others. In fact, there was a report that was done, oh my God, back in like 2009. It showed that we were just on the transit side, that there's $80 billion that is in terms of backlog of state of good repair. And that's in almost 50 million of it was across what we call the big nine systems. And we're the fifth of those. Okay.
Wow.
So, oh yeah. So, I mean, it's. So we got plenty of infrastructure that needs reinvestment. But Marguerite, let me just get, now you got me now truly on a soapbox, because it's not just about transit. Okay, this is, if you look at all these doggone reports that are out there, and there's enough of them, American infrastructure, period, is batting a D+.
Yeah.
And it's a doggone shame.
It
it's
is.
A crying shame.
It is.
I don't care if you look at electricity. I don't care if you look at utilities. I don't care if you look at transportation, bridges, whatever. We're at D+. And what do we not get about how stupid that is? We have got to make major changes and adjustments in terms of reinvesting in these pillars that have made us competitive in who we are. And I think that's one thing that's really great about being in this region. Like, I don't like the whole thing in terms of the repeal. I really don't, okay?
The gas tax repeal.
But you can also tell that people, in terms of what happened with the investment, that they do get it in terms of the need to invest. It's just that we've got to do a lot more education. Because as soon as you ask somebody, well, do you really want to wind up, there's this kind of like anti-tax sentiment. But I think at the bottom line, people really do get the need for investment. We just got to work harder.
Okay, speaking of up the gazoo, your expression a minute ago, we have a ton of Facebook postings and email and tweets for you. So let's try to run through some of them quickly.
Okay.
Here's Pablo. Why, regarding the blue line, why the PR announcements on the train ad nauseum, including admonitions to not smoke on the train? Is this really necessary? How about that, the Pablo?
Well, you know what, Pablo, I will take that into, but we try to make sure that we're giving as much information as we possibly can wind up giving. And then some of the announcements that we make are honestly, Pablo, to help in terms of our customers who are visually impaired and all of that. So there's a lot of different reasons that we wind up doing the announcements. We'll tell you things like we want to really wind up pumping. Think about it. It's, you know, we want you to see something. We want you to say something. We want you to be safe. We want you to know that there's been a diversion here. So I know it's almost like I'm hearing you maybe a little bit like, okay, Bev, but you can have, you know, visual pollution and we can have a little bit too much. So, but we try to balance it, but that's why we do it.
Hey, Pablo's not done.
Oh,
Pablo has more, but by the way, he does end by saying best regards to you. So that's very
kind. Thank you, Pablo.
His next one is the red line. We just did the blue line. On the rare times I take this into the city from Braintree, it's a nightmare of overcrowding. I should be paid hazard pay for that experience. What steps are being taken to address? By the way, Beverly Scott God is smiling, Pablo. I want you to know. Go ahead.
Pablo, I tell you the honest to God's truth. I want to tell you, we do feel your pain, and that goes right back to this conversation that we were having, Pablo. We just need to be able to make a bigger investment, okay? That's just all it is to it. Certainly, it's going to wind up. I should say this. The new cars that are coming in are actually have a greater capacity, okay? And so at a minimum, we wind up picking up like an additional 15 spaces per.
And when are they online, theoretically, if all goes well?
Well, all goes well, we'll start seeing, we have orange and red, we'll start seeing the first pilot cars, and there's six of each pilot car, will start coming in 2018. Okay?
Are they going to be like the Green Line, the new Green Line cars that are kind of like on two levels? You know how they're kind of step up, step down?
Well, they will have they'll be like a low floor, okay? And I'm saying, and so very comfortable.
Those are nice.
Oh, I know. And it's just going to be great. So anyway, there will be a little bit greater capacity that will wind up. And then the other thing that we're looking at too, Pablo, is to be able to really wind up making the power and signaling adjustments so that we can wind up getting greater capacity, if you will, over on the red line. But at the end of the day, I will tell you, I'm being clear to everybody, it takes, you got to have hay to make the bricks, okay? And so there will not wind up, without increased investment in the system, we're just not going to be able to wind up making there be a whole lot more to bring relief.
You know, we're talking with General Manager Bev Scott from the MBTA. You know, here's what you were talking about before. This is a question from one of the people on Facebook. I think this is Ramsey.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. And talking about our transit system compared to some of the rest of the world. Ramsey lives in Cambridge, said he or she used to live in Seoul, South Korea, where the transit system, according to Ramsey, has delays measurable in seconds, not minutes. Stations are clean. Very few buses have long waits. Stations have good signage, instructing people, even though they don't speak Korean. And it seems like, and this is the thing, they probably have the same huge state investment there. And
they do.
Well, it's also new, is it, by comparison?
It is, but do you know what? I mean, I know you do know. Some of the countries are literally opening up subway systems every year, okay? They're putting in, like, not India, China, Korea. These are countries that are putting in almost 9 and 10% of their GDP into infrastructure investment, okay?
Wow.
And so I know I'm getting a little excited here.
I find it depressing.
It's the truth.
I'm with you, though. I find it very upsetting that when you go to the airports, not that I travel very much, but sometimes you go to an airport overseas and you think, wow, not that Logan's a dump or anything, but these other places, they're just much better.
So you know what it all to me, like it really, it's all this stuff is like going back to the future. That's why you see us with all this, like make it in Massachusetts. I call them like the localization projects, or like on the Green Line extension, we have a WIN program, Workforce Initiative Now. It's all about reinvesting in ourselves, the investments that we wind up making in infrastructure. This is nothing new.
So why?
This is going back to the New Deal. Okay. What helped to make us great? We invested in ourselves. Every single drop of building and hammering on stuff and bringing stuff in, and we're investing in jobs and communities and all of that. And when we not only think about it, but do it that way and actually do a lot of that work here instead of shipping it every place. I tell you the honest to God's truth. I think it is key. It was key to getting us great, and it's going to be key to making us stay
so
great.
So let me just ask you one last thing on this. I hate to sound
go
obsessed
ahead,
with this,
ahead,
but
Margaret,
I just find it politically sort of fascinating as well. And I'm wondering about your perspective. We have decided kind of let everything fall apart. I mean, we had that terrible story the other day about the Long Island Bridge falling apart. You know, the bridges are all...
Water mains are exploding. 100-year-old water mains under old cities.
So you're a politician. What are the politics of this? Why did this happen? Did we just...
I answer after the general manager of the team? Because I have an answer for that, too.
We've just kind of said we're going to be like, we're almost becoming the poor sisters of the whole world.
Do you
here.
Want my answer first? And you can
respond. You go ahead.
2 months ago when the governor was here for his monthly visit, I said, tell me I'm not wrong about this. I don't know if we're talking about infrastructure, but some long-term investment that consciously or otherwise legislators make the following calculation. Is the bridge going to fall down? Is the water main going to explode? Or is the whatever going to happen on my watch? If it's not going to happen while I'm here, let the next guy or woman deal with it. Because I don't get any points fixing something where my constituents don't see the immediate bang for their buck. Is that not a fair description?
I think that's a part of it. And then I think the other part of it is that we're victims of our own success. Okay. One thing infrastructure is, it's not something that, you know, it's 30, 40, 50 years, okay? And so, candidly, what we wound up doing, we built back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And then, for all practical purposes, 60s, we went on cruise control, okay? And we went on cruise control. Then we did all this stupid stuff, like, you know, it's a symbiote, like we call freeway. Like, freeway, what's free about a freeway? Okay, you know, then you think about all the kind of kooky stuff we do, and this gets into our psyche. And then we went on cruise control, honestly, in terms of making investment. I'm no better than anybody else. I tell people all the time, I grew up in the whole thing. I bought the American Dream hook, line, and sinker. If one car was good, three cars were better, you know, get an acre, whatever. And then I learned, okay, largely a lot had to do with my son and his group, okay. I learned.
Was
I
your
said,
son and his group?
Oh, my son, they're wonderful, okay. I call it my new wave, new age, okay. You know what I'm saying? But it was like, Mom, stop smoking, okay. You're messing up the environment. You're killing yourself and you're messing up the environment. Mom, okay, you know. So what I got a wake-up call, and I said, Bev, you know better now. You got to do better, okay? And so I really do this whole thing in terms of I worry about the fact that my granddaughters, okay, they're not going to have it as good as this generation unless we do something about it. You know what I'm saying? And so it is all about it is a generational responsibility. We went on cruise control. Things were easy, okay? We kind of lost our edge, okay? And we kind of drinking on ya-ya, okay? You know, like, you know, we keep remembering all the old stuff. Yeah. We got to get out there and scrap, okay? You know what I'm saying? And that means that we've got to be prepared to make investments in ourselves and then hold everybody accountable. You know, I don't say that we get a pass at the T or any place else in terms of cost containment. You know, it's not like you get an inoculation for life, cost containment, internal productivity and all that. But let's don't fool ourselves. We are not going to cost contain ourselves out of making major infrastructure investments that are needed. And so we need public support to be able to do that. And I think a lot of information, a lot of education, a lot of keeping our nose clean, doing the best we can every day, but we have got to make investments in ourselves.
Okay, three quick ones before you go, Beverly Scott. When we go from the gazoo to the ya-ya, to quote you. And by the way, we had a ton of questions for Beverly Scott, and those which we don't get to, we will forward to her office. Okay. Three quick ones. Clara writes, you have an online form for complaints at the T. What happens after that? How does the resolution get back to the, she describes as the complainer?
Do you know what? I know that we answer them, okay? You know what I'm saying? And so, and we have a metric, okay, which is that there's, you know, that you know, they're supposed to wind up being answered, and we're supposed to get to things. We call it almost like a 95 and 5, okay? And we've been running something like about 84, 85%, but it's been coming up. And then all of the ones that wind up coming to my office, I have them on, and people have no trepidation, okay, about coming through. I tell my team I want them out of there within no more than a 5-day period of time.
And if they haven't gotten a response, who should they contact?
Come to bscott@mbta.com.
bscott@mbta.com. It's you. Second question of three final ones, and we cannot tell a lie. This is actually from our lead producer. It's unfair, but she slipped one in there. Mm. It's from Chelsea. How come you can buy Charlie cards at only a few stations? Why not have them sold at a vending machine at every station? I think that's a fabulous question.
Do you know what?
Be nice to her. She's in charge of the
show. Okay. You know, we have been looking at how we can wind up being able to improve the distribution, okay, as well as be able to take a lot of the transactions that we do on the buses off of the buses. So what I'll say is that you can come back with me when I come back the next time. I think I'm going to have some new information on that. But
fabulous.
We've been really taking a look at it.
And on the way out the door, I want to compliment you, the Transportation Secretary, and the Governor for finally naming a building after Michael Dukakis.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, in typical humble fashion, he's going to be here next Friday, so we'll talk to him about it. He didn't want a name for him. He says no one's going to use the name. They're just going to call it South Station. Good for you for recognizing a dedicated Massachusetts servant through
South
the
Station
years.
Transportation Center name for him.
Isn't it wonderful?
Yes.
And then I want to say something before. I just want to, talking about responsibility, I just want to thank all the veterans who have served, okay, because if not for them, G, you know, so thank you very much.
You're kind to say that. Beverly Scott, it's great to see
you.
We
didn't get to the hybrid car buses.
Next time.
I'm sorry.
bscott@mbta.org.
.com.
You're in big trouble, let me tell you.
Bev Scott, thank you very much for coming in. Bev Scott is the general manager of the MBTA. She joins us on a regular basis to take our questions and yours. Thanks so much for being here, Bev. Up next, we mark Veterans Day with a Marine who served 4 deployments in Iraq. Congressman-elect Seth Moulton joins us to talk about his military career and what he aims to do for other vets when he returns to Washington. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie Egan. To mark Veterans Day, we're talking to someone who's very much a modern-day veteran. He joined the Marine Corps right before the September 11th attacks, went on to serve 4 deployments to Iraq. In his final deployment, he served directly under General Petraeus as part of the 2007-2008 surge. He joins us to remember veterans and discuss how he aims to help them when he heads to Capitol Hill next year, obviously talking about Congressman-elect Seth Moulton. Seth, congratulations, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Yeah, thank you, Congressman-elect, for being here. Before we start, I want to play you 2 clips from the President of the United States, Seth Moulton. This is President Obama saying 3 times, first on June 13th, then on 19th, then on September 11th, that we will not be sending U.S. troops to fight in Iraq.
We will not be sending U.S. troops back into combat in Iraq. American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq. We will send an additional 475 service members to Iraq. As I've said before, these American forces will not have a combat mission.
Okay, and now here's President Obama on Face the Nation yesterday, asked by Bob Schieffer whether we're going to send even more troops into Iraq, and the president wouldn't say yes or no.
Should we expect that more troops may be needed before this is over?
You know, as Commander-in-Chief, I'm never going to say never, but what the commanders who presented the plan to me say is that we may actually see fewer troops over time because now we're seeing coalition members starting to partner with us on the training and assist effort.
So, Congressman-elect Moulton, I know you have said you support Obama's plans to target the Islamic insurgents, but oppose the use of ground troops to deal with the threat. So what do you make of this 1,500 more troops?
Well, I think it's dangerous, and we could quickly get on a slippery slope. Now, understand, I think the president is right to say that he should reserve the option, he should keep all options on the table. That's his responsibility. And I've been very clear that I'm opposed to using U.S. ground troops now. It doesn't mean that this circumstances couldn't change in the future. But from everything I know about the situation there today, I don't think that using ground troops is a good idea. At the end of the day, this is the Iraqis' fight, and Iraq has got to be able to defend its own borders and protect its own people. And the problem with sending more U.S. troops into an advisory role is that I know from my own experience that being a military advisor can very quickly turn a ground combat role. That was actually my mission with my Marine platoon on my second deployment in 2004, 10 years ago. We were military advisors in Iraq, and when the Iraqi unit that we were assigned to mentor and work with started to get overrun by the militia in Najaf, that started the Battle of Najaf. We went to their assistance, and it was the worst ground combat of the war until that time. So a military advisory mission can very quickly become a ground combat mission. I mean, let's not forget, the Vietnam War started as a military advisory mission.
Well, also, Seth Moulton, isn't it true that this 1,500, this doubling of troops, are going to be closer to combat, physically closer to combat, than those who preceded them a couple of months ago?
Jim, I don't know the exact details, but I know that we're talking about advisors who will essentially be working with Iraqi troops, and you're not going to let your unit, that you're partnered with, just become overrun and get decimated by the enemy without doing what you can to help them. I mean, that's just common sense and basic respect that you establish when you help a foreign military. So it's certainly a risk.
Seth Moulton, you are joining, when you're sworn in January, the numbers are not yet final, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 100, just over 100 veterans of, well, not just recent wars, but veterans of wars. Is there a common thread through Republicans and Democrats about this ground troop thing, or are veterans in Congress as all over the place as they are on all other issues?
Well, I'm sure there's a common thread in that, you know, many of us have seen the effects of the Iraq War firsthand, or at least from a distance, but with the perspective of being a veteran. And we certainly don't want to repeat the mistakes that have been made there in the past. But I think there are different opinions on how to best go about that. I'm very frustrated that we are where we are today. I think the Iraq War was a mistake. I don't think we should have gotten involved. But at the same time, I don't think it had to end so poorly. And I think that one of the lessons that we must take out of Iraq is that not only do we have to be careful about getting into wars, we also have to be careful about how we get out of them. And that's certainly a lesson we have to very carefully apply to Afghanistan, where we're trying to withdraw our troops today.
What does that mean? Tell us what that would mean in terms of getting out of Afghanistan, Seth Moulton.
Well, if you think back to the surge in Iraq, when General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker came back and reported to Congress on their progress, they basically made two points. They said, militarily, we've made tremendous progress, in fact, exceeded our expectations. And therefore, it was okay to start withdrawing combat troops. But they also said that they had not made as much political progress as they need. And the prescription was to have a diplomatic surge. In fact, we built the largest American embassy in the world in Baghdad. But then we left it half full. We never provided that diplomatic surge to mentor the Iraqi government. And the political mess in Iraq that we have today has come partly as a result. I'm not saying that it's our fault, per se, but we knew that the Iraqis needed more help to get their government on track. Instead, we didn't give them that help. Prime Minister Maliki developed an incredibly sectarian government that got so bad it lost the faith and trust of its own army. And now we have the political and military disaster that we see in Iraq today.
You know, Seth Moulton, you obviously are in touch with a lot of the men and women that you serve with over there. I wonder, everyone's different, obviously, but I wonder, with things so difficult now in Iraq, what's it like for those who served with you and went through, lost their fellow men and women, servicemen, and to see this whole situation over there now? How hard is that?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult because, you know, we put everything we had into making Iraq succeed, even those of us who thought it was a bad idea to begin with. I mean, every single day in Iraq, I did the best I could and worked very hard, risked my life, and saw others killed and maimed because of the commitment they had to serving our country and to trying to make it work. So it's very frustrating. But there's another level to it, too, and that is that every one of us was there proud to be there so that nobody had to go in our place, proud to serve alongside the servicemen and women next to us. And that doesn't change. You know, I don't think back and say, I wish I hadn't gone, because I was proud to serve my country. And although I certainly wish that we had a better result, I'm still very proud to have served.
We're talking with Seth Moulton, who was just elected to be the congressman from the 6th Congressional District. You know, Seth, there was a terrific piece written a while ago about you in Boston Magazine, and it talked about when you were over there in Iraq, you had an interpreter, a guy named Mohammed, and you guys apparently had a brief but very popular TV show over there called Moulton and Mohammed. What was that about? It was on Iraqi TV, is that right?
Well, that's right, and you know, this is a much brighter part of the whole war, really, because this was back in the summer of 2003. And, you know, the summer of 2003 was just a heyday in Iraq. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a more hopeful, optimistic, and excited place on earth than Iraq 2003, right after the Iraqis had been liberated. So it was quite a contrast to what we see in Iraq today. But as we know, there was no plan whatsoever on our part. You know, we had an invasion plan. We didn't have an occupation or a reconstruction plan.
Yep.
And so different lieutenants were assigned to do different things. I was assigned to work with the Iraqi media. And before I knew it, I had a TV station, a radio station, and a newspaper all under my control in southern Iraq. So Rupert Murdoch had nothing on Second Lieutenant Moulton in Iraq 2003. And quite a little empire there. But it was a fascinating job because we had to teach the Iraqis the principles of a free press. They had no idea how to put together an evening news broadcast. In fact, the TV station had just played a feed from the Ministry of Information in Baghdad. And so that when that feed was shut off, they had no idea what to do. And one of the things my translator Mohammed and I did is we did some segments on TV, both to just explain things to the Iraqi people and also to show the Iraqi media folks how to put together a TV show. Now, much to our surprise, it did actually become quite popular. And before I knew it, we were signing autographs in the streets.
So,
yeah,
it was an extraordinary experience.
I think that the fact that you and Mohammed both look like movie stars, Seth Moulton, probably didn't hurt. I saw pictures of him. He's a pretty handsome guy, too. But there's a follow-up story to this, that Mohammed, obviously a smart guy as well, got a Fulbright scholarship, came to the United States. But he was warned not to return home because, of course, he worked so closely to the coalition forces. What happened to Mohammed?
Well, that's right. He came here on his own, to his credit. He got a Fulbright scholarship, came to the U.S., and here was someone who had risked his life, not just for his country, but for ours. And so he was here in 2006, 2007, when the civil war worsened in Iraq, and it would have been a death sentence for him to go back. I mean, not only was he a translator who had worked with us, but he was a very famous translator because he was on TV, and insurgents came to his family's home and threatened them so many times that they had to pack up and move to a different city. So Mohammed sought asylum, and through the program set up by Senator Kennedy and others to ensure that our supporters over there could come to the U.S. if they needed to, he started going through that bureaucratic process. But I tell you, the bureaucracy was unbelievable, even for someone who had given so much to America. And I was fortunate to find a lawyer at a big law firm who took on the case pro bono. But Mohammed had to live at my family's home because he couldn't get a work permit while he was waiting for his case to be adjudicated. So in 2007, 2008, when I was redeployed to Iraq for my fourth tour, my parents had Mohammed living in their home in Marblehead.
So he's able to stay. He's here, right?
That's right. So eventually he got his work permit, and he actually became Phil Sandover's first ever Arabic teacher.
That's great.
Wow.
And he's gone on from that to do other things. But it's a great example of how someone who really deserved to come to America just because of all he had done for our country overseas has become a tremendous asset to our nation here at home.
I was afraid you were going to tell me it had a different ending, that they sent him back, and I was just going to have a heart attack. But thank God they didn't send him back, and he's here, and that's great.
Now, Seth Moulton,
this is a good story, but there are others that don't end that way.
Yeah.
There are an awful lot of our supporters in Iraq and Afghanistan who are still waiting for what has been promised them, a chance to come to America just for their own safety, but also to make us a better country.
Yeah, Seth Moulton, those of us who followed your campaign against Richard Tesei realize that a centerpiece was your goal, if you were elected, which you were starting in January, to make lives better for the men and women who have served our country. And I should say, doing talk radio for years, we know everybody talks the talk, but almost nobody walks the walk when it comes to supporting people who have put their lives at risk and the families of those people. Tell us what's atop your veterans-related agenda when you begin serving in January, Seth?
Well, the first thing I want to work on is VA health care. I get my health care from the VA, so I know that the system is broken. And it doesn't mean the entire system is broken. I think the bureaucracy is terribly outdated. I actually have a great doctor. I have a great primary care physician. I feel in good hands when I'm in his care. But if he sends me down the hall to get my blood drawn, I can wait 2 hours to get that done. Or if he refers me to a specialist, I can wait months to get an appointment. So the system is broken, and we should be giving the absolute best care to our veterans, and in some cases they get the worst. So I'm going to work on that, and of course it's not going to be easy, But it's an issue where even as a freshman Democrat, I can have some credibility. We've never had fewer veterans in Congress than we do today, and we have very few combat veterans in Congress. And it's also a place that we can find a lot of bipartisan support. I mean, Republicans and Democrats all want to take better care of our veterans. We just need to make sure we find the way to do it.
You know, when you talk about the VA healthcare system, a lot of people who are pretty smart who have done what you've done with your life say the best way to fix the VA healthcare system is to get rid of the VA healthcare system and allow men and women who've served to be able to access the obviously covered by the government, access private healthcare, not through the VA. Why is that not a good idea rather than living through what has happened the last several years?
Well, I think that certainly when veterans can't get the best care available from the VA,
right? I meant beyond that.
Yeah, be able to access the private healthcare system.
Maybe how about
that's
in general?
A no-brainer for me. But you know, there actually are some studies that show parts of the VA do a very, very good job. And so I think that we need to understand better where the VA works and where it doesn't work. You know, one of the fascinating statistics I learned about VA healthcare is that the peak of claims from World War One. From World War One was not in 1920 or 1925, but in 1969. Hmm. So the VA bureaucracy was really built for World War One veterans. So it's terribly out of date. I mean, the VA has a good reputation for taking care of men and women who come back missing limbs, for example. But they are terrible at taking care of veterans who need mental health care. That's an issue that's more relevant today because so many brain injuries were fatal before that people are now able to survive. And so traumatic brain injury wasn't even around 10 years ago because people who had it just died. But now kids come home with that. They need care, and the VA is not providing it. But the other thing that statistic shows is that claims for the VA will only keep going up. I mean, we haven't even reached the peak for the Vietnam War yet. A lot of Vietnam veterans are just now recognizing that their cancer or Parkinson's disease is traceable back to the Agent Orange exposure they had 40 years ago. So that means that if the VA healthcare system can't take care of the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans today, we haven't even begun to see the beginning of the problem. So this is a real serious crisis. And we need to make sure we fix the bureaucracy, not just throw more money at the existing bureaucracy.
We're talking to Seth Moulton, the congressman-elect from the 6th District. I saw the guy, the new head of the VA from Procter & Gamble on 60 Minutes the other night, Seth Moulton. What's the word on the street about him? He was very emotional, a veteran himself. I don't know if a businessman is the guy to run the place, but what's the word on the street?
The word on the street is that it's a positive change. But I have yet to meet him myself. I look forward to doing so.
You know, when you mentioned someone who lost a limb, did you hear the story yesterday, Seth Moulton, that I hope I got this right, that the first member of the armed forces who lost a limb and got a prosthetic started a further deployment? I'm not sure if it's Iraq or Afghanistan. Did you hear about this?
I didn't hear about that story specifically, but I'll tell you, one of the things that's amazing about our veterans is that so many of us come home and want to serve again. Either back in the military, go back and rejoin those comrades that we had left, or serve somewhere back at home. You know, we talk a lot about the greatest generation from World War II. But people often forget that term was not coined in 1946. In fact, the greatest generation wasn't a phrase that popped up until the 1990s. So it had as much to do with what our World War II veterans did after the war as what they did in it.
Hey, Seth Moulton, last thing from me. I asked you about the core of veterans, Republicans and Democrats. I understand on veterans issues, hopefully there'll be more bipartisanship than this pathetic Congress has exhibited or anything else. But does the bond that you all have that none of us can understand because we didn't live through what you lived through, does it mean that, you know, the Jody Ernst, the pig castrator from Iowa, elected to the United States Senate, does that allow you, hopefully, to work more closely with the Jody Ernsts of the world on non-veterans issues because of that relationship you have from what you experienced that the rest of us have not?
I certainly hope it does. And I think that it will, because that's the experience that a lot of members of Congress said they had coming out of World War II, when there were so many World War II veterans serving in Congress on both sides of the aisle. You know, it's about developing respect. You have to have respect from for people who disagree with you. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but you ought to at least understand their positions and respect why they believe what they do. And that's something that we had to do in the military. You know, I didn't have a platoon of all Democrats. we came together. I mean, I had Marines from all over the country,
right.
Massachusetts and Vermont, Alabama and Texas, California, Utah. And we came together with remarkably different backgrounds, different religious beliefs, different political beliefs. But at the end of the day, we were able to set aside those differences to do what's best for America. And fundamentally, I think that's what Americans expect of Congress as well.
Indeed. Congratulations, Seth Moulton, on your election. We look forward to you serving.
Thanks for having me.
Seth Moulton is an Iraq War veteran and the congressman-elect from the 6th Congressional District. Thank you again, Seth, for being with us. Up next, WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen joins us to go over the latest arts events in town, from the small stage to the silver screen. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson has weighed in on the new film Interstellar. He's given it high marks for accurately portraying the scientific principles of relativity, gravitational fields, and evolution. But does Interstellar follow the artistic principles of good filmmaking? For that answer, we turn to the Neil deGrasse Tyson of the Arts Universe. That, of course, would be Jared Bowen. He's embarrassed. Jared Bowen is the host of Open Studio. He's also GBH's arts editor. Hey there, Jared.
Hey there. I'm going to disappoint already. You measure my intelligence by Tyson, and that's it.
That's our goal.
That's right.
That's our goal, to bring
that's
it
right.
down a peg.
So I want to know, Matthew McConaughey, I always mispronounce
McConaughey.
McConaughey seems
hey,
to be whatever it is, and Anne Hathaway. I mean, it's got great potential there, right? And they're both in this movie. So what's the verdict?
What's the story?
Okay, well, the story, I can describe that because I certainly cannot describe the science here, but we're sometime in the future where everybody's driving pickup trucks and wearing Carhartt, and corn is the last crop on the planet. It evokes the time of Steinbeck and Dust Bowls consuming the planet because we've destroyed it. So Matthew McConaughey, who is a pilot, stumbles upon this NASA group led by Michael Caine, who goes around spouting Dylan Thomas poetry to inspire his staff. Don't we all wish we had leaders like that?
Yes.
And so he shoots off into outer space because basically they have one plan to rescue the planet, which is to recolonize on another planet. So Matthew McConaughey must leave his family behind, including his young daughter, Murph, who he doesn't want to lose. But they're traveling so far and through a wormhole into a different galaxy that his family, he believes, may not even age during the entire time he's gone. And this is where Neil deGrasse Tyson should step in, because I can't even begin to describe the science here. But Anne Hathaway is his co-pilot, and I find it to be this very, very uplifting piece.
By the way, I can't remember. Did you like Gravity?
I did like Gravity.
I was waiting to see it. I thought it was grossly overrated. I have
oh,
to
I
say,
liked it.
I really did. And from the reviews I've seen so far, this takes it even one step farther, right? I mean, this has gotten rave reviews.
Yeah,
yes.
This is a
not just
actually,
as a science.
Not all rave reviews.
They
no.
haven't been. No,
oh, really?
I mean, I'm going to stick my neck out here and say I felt that this was a masterpiece. It has
really?
the skeleton of 2001: A Space Odyssey, but it works in this great filmmaking of today, of 2014. By the way, I saw this in the IMAX theater, and I suggest that everybody see it there. Although the sound is so loud that I felt like I had to drive straight to Mass General after, so that I could have all of my organs realigned because they were vibrating.
Can we hear a little bit of this, by the way? This is obviously from the trailer for the movie Interstellar. Here it is.
This world's a treasure. It's been telling us to leave for a while now.
Your daughter's generation will be the last to survive on Earth. You're the best pilot we ever had. Get out there and save the world.
Everybody ready to say goodbye to our solar system?
our galaxy.
Here we go.
You might have to decide between seeing your children again and the future of the human race.
Can I tell you, I hear McConaughey's voice and my knees buckle. I mean, the guy is so spectacular.
What
I mean, it's
unbelievable.
Story,
he was such a pretty boy throwaway.
Yes.
And talk about a 180-degree turn in the career. That's why I asked you if he was good in this. And he's supposedly fantastic in this, right?
He has taken charge of his career and of this film, too. He really is. I mean, what moved it so well for me? First of all, I have to say that I don't see many trailers or commercials, but the ones I do see today are just market the movie so horribly. This one, what you just played, has it spot on. There's a terrific humanity and spirit and faith in the human condition and the human cause in this film, so much so, led by Matthew McConaughey, who is so positive and optimistic about wanting to save the planet and save his family, but not in the most corny way, that I had this never happens. I actually sat in the theater for a couple minutes as soon as the film ended because there was so much to process and take in. I needed to just let it settle within me before driving over to Mass General.
Okay, so let's go from the best of humanity to the worst of humanity. Here's a little scene from the trailer to Nightcrawler. Now, speaking of pronunciation, it's Gyllenhaal is how you say it, right?
Gyllenhaal.
Jake Gyllenhaal. Here's a little bit of that.
Who am I? I'm a hard worker. I set high goals, and I've been told that I'm persistent.
And I'm thinking the television news might just be something I love as well as something I happen to be good at.
Now, I know that today's work culture no longer caters to the job loyalty that could be promised to earlier generations. What I believe is that good things come to those who work their asses off. My motto is, if you want to win the lottery, you have to make the money to buy a ticket. You have to make the money to buy a ticket. You have to make
okay,
the money to
Jake Gyllenhaal looks like an absolute lunatic
in
this
lunatic
movie. But tell us the premise, which has driven me over the edge, of this movie,
this too,
please.
Actually.
Well, this is an entire indictment of the news industry, and I thought it was a little bit cliched and more of where we are as a society in terms of embracing news and reality TV and seeing carnage on screen until I was talking to Emily Rooney the other night and she confirmed a lot of what I saw in this film actually happens. But he plays a stringer, a video stringer. So he's out at night prowling the streets of Los Angeles, listening to scanners so that he can come upon accidents and fires and murders, and he films them and goes to the third-rated television station in Los Angeles where Rene Russo is the overnight producer, and he's selling this video to her. And it becomes this very unseemly exchange because he has no scruples. So at one point, he happens upon an accident scene and rearranges the body because he's the first on the scene just so he can have
better shot
composition.
That
yeah,
is great.
Exactly. But Jake Gyllenhaal, I read this. I believe it was in the Boston Globe that he lost about 20 pounds for this role. So he's got these sunken cheeks and these big, big eyes because he saw himself as a coyote, which of course prowl Los Angeles. They're widespread out there. And he felt he was this sort of same carnivorous character. And he's so creepy and disgusting in this film.
Well, there's this great line from Rene Russo that was quoted in one of the reviews saying that what they want in this TV station is footage of preferably a screaming woman running down the street with her throat cut. Geez, I don't think we're that bad.
In the suburbs.
They want somebody that's white. They want someone that's
right,
white,
exactly,
and well-heeled as opposed to someone that's down their luck or poor or minority, whatever it is.
Don't you think that's kind of some of the mentality of where news is headed today and reality TV and what people want to see?
She was hired last night to be the head of a local news station, actually.
Tom Wolfe had a great line in the book that you love, Bonfire of the Vanities, which has got to be 20 years old now, about the great white defendant. So I suppose there is some sense if there is some, you know, some high and mighty person that has some horrible thing happen to them, there is more media attention, unfairly, but there is.
Oh, absolutely. And this film also says so much about commerce today. I mean, here's somebody who at the beginning of the film, he's trying to sell scrap metal. And by the end, he's built an industry for himself on other people's misery. And this becomes enterprise for him. And he's so proud of it. And Los Angeles is full of enablers for this to happen. I mean, there's so much to just like Interstellar, there's so much to think about after you leave this film, and you feel very dirty. And I think in a lot of good ways that make us think about where we are in terms of media today.
Yeah, so I spent 8 hours, as you know, watching television on Sunday. I think next Sunday, 8 hours at the movies. This, I mean, I'll tell you. Okay, Rosewater is John Stewart is The Daily Show's first foray into movie making. Tell the story. I think people know, but tell the story and tell us what you thought of his work.
Well, Maziar Bahari is a reporter who's working for Newsweek and a few different other organizations.
You interviewed him, right?
Yeah, you did a great interview with him.
I just saw it this morning.
Yeah, I talked
it was
to the real-life guy last night on Greater Boston, and he is an Iranian-born. So for the 2009 elections for Ahmadinejad, he went there to cover this for various news outlets. And this is a person whose sister and father had already been arrested. So the Iranian authorities were sort of already on to him. But after when he began reporting out the elections and how the polling was shut down because this was controlled by the Ahmadinejad regime, they arrested him. And he spent 118 days in jail. Part of the reason he was arrested is because he had done a segment for The Daily Show at one point, and it was ha-ha funny talking about being a spy. But the Iranians used that as evidence against him.
And they didn't get the fact that it was intended to be satire of
they
sorts,
did not,
right?
Yes. No, they were happy to use it against him. So the film, directed by Jon Stewart, people know he took a fair amount of time off last year, and it's because he wanted to direct this film because, in part, he felt some culpability, mm-hmm. although Bahari told me he didn't truly. He just was so invested in this case. But he took time off to direct this film, write this film, and put it out there. And so it takes us through these 118 days, basically through the point of view of Bahari in jail with Rosewater, who is his interrogator, in the back and forth. And he has no idea that there's this major cry happening outside, led by Hillary Clinton and his pregnant wife in London, to get him released from jail.
You know, the first thing he said in your interview, and then you asked the question that I'm glad you asked, he says, "I knew I'd get out of jail sometime, and I knew I'd write the book." I'm saying to myself,
yeah,
you knew you'd get out of jail based on what? I mean, he seems so calm about the whole thing. Was that not your impression?
He seemed incredibly calm, and I don't know if he didn't want to agitate further. I doubt that's the case, but I will say that there are some flaws in the filmmaking here. It is Jon Stewart's directorial debut. And I don't mean to say this lightly, but it's almost the Martha Stewart method of interrogation. I mean, there's interrogation. He wasn't excruciatingly abused. Yes, he was in jail. Yes, he was treated poorly. But as the film illustrates, there was a relationship that developed between the two.
Yeah. They're now, asking him a lot of questions about sex, from what I've read. That was one of their big themes.
Well, they had, these strange preoccupations, partly because they found the Sopranos DVDs among his belongings. And Leonard
great.
Cohen.
That's so
suddenly
great.
He was a spy for the Israelis for having Leonard Cohen and into sex for having The Sopranos.
Okay, so let's move on to Swan Lake. You know, it is amazing. It's so old, you know, more than 100 years old, Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, and it's still being done over and over again. A new production by the Boston Ballet. What do we think?
The lake scenes are beautiful. This is all done by Mikko Nissinen, who is their artistic director. It's his choreography, and he has reteamed with Robert Perziola, who helped redesign The Nutcracker a couple of years ago. And so they give it this sort of ethereal view of Swan Lake. It's more storybook. It's not timed to any specific time, so you feel like you've literally just opened a book before you, and especially with the scenic backdrops, it's gorgeous. And I as I said just a second ago, I think the lake scenes are breathtaking. Just the color palette, the costumes, the dancing is extraordinary with the full company on stage, you know, all dancing together in this flock of swans. And there's a moment in Act 3, which is just when they're back in the lake, and it's absolutely breathtaking, sort of a surprise that happens. And it was great to be in the Opera House. You know, I think it's 2,600 seats and a collective gasp by the audience because they're so moved by the beauty.
By the way, how many times have you seen this? Not this production, but how many productions have you seen?
Not very many, actually.
You know, it seems that when something like this is done so many times, isn't the burden on the people who put it together so much greater? When you're doing something fresh, obviously it's hard, but you've got to come up with something new so that people like you don't say it was very nice, but it's essentially same old, right?
Right, and I think that's what they did here. Fortunately, you know, not calling in Natalie Portman or something to recreate Black Swan. But
that was the most depressing thing I ever saw.
Okay, so let's move to the play, which I think is about my father's family. It's called Bad Jews, and let's play a little sound. No, believe me. This is from a play. In this scene, there are two cousins who are arguing about the strength of their Israeli heritage. Here it is.
In the hopes of more Jews winning Nobel Prizes, I should marry a Jew? Is that seriously your point?
No. My point is, play this out. You get married. You two get married, and you have kids. So they're half Jewish and half Delaware. And that kid marries someone who is Asian, and they have a kid. And so that kid is a quarter Jewish, a quarter Delaware, and half Asian. And that kid marries someone who is half Black and half Puerto Rican, and they have a kid. And so that kid is...
They're American!
In several generations, all these kids are running around bearing the hyphenated names of cultures that no longer exist.
Okay.
Sounds pretty good to me.
This is tough.
Well, tell us. It's set right in this. Is the whole thing in this little tiny studio apartment?
In this little apartment, which is significant because here you have a group of cousins. They're all in their early 20s. And by the way, this is a play that did very well in New York last year. So it's being staged here by Speakeasy Stage Company. And you have these four cousins coming together because their grandfather, a Holocaust survivor, has just died. But what I really appreciated is the vantage point, because you have these 20-somethings who are very detached now from World War II and the Holocaust and that legacy. And one set of cousins come from a wealthy family whose parents could buy them this apartment. The other cousin, Daphne, who you just heard, that the woman was comes from two public school teachers, so she already has resentment against that side of the family for the money that they have. And she is so into her Jewish heritage. She wants to move to Israel after graduating from Vassar and join the Israeli army. And then you have her other cousins who are very indifferent. And so it becomes this push back and forth about why is she so religious? Why does she feel so tied to her family's legacy? And in the end, they're all fighting over their grandfather's high, his piece of jewelry that he had always worn and kept through the Holocaust underneath his tongue. Yeah, so it's very poignant to her. But the discussion about being Jewish and why you're so faithful, especially from the cousin who's pretty agnostic at this point, I think is so resonant today when we're talking about any religion, and especially this religion with, you know, all of the legacy that comes with it.
I think you should go see it.
Relate
to this.
No, well, I don't know. Yeah, actually, it sounds great. No, I'm serious.
You're not convinced.
Okay, fine.
You're not convinced.
Can we move to I saw another piece you did. I don't mean just to praise you here today. Next week we'll trash
Why not?
You, I'm sure,
it was
to
a
balance
great piece. It was a great piece.
I knew nothing about the background of these Fenway Studios.
That
wasn't
great.
It was spectacular.
I've never heard of it. Recognized the building outside.
So
and I
did
thought,
I
had no idea what was going on inside this Fenway building.
Tell us about the history and the rules of how you play and the whole deal.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of it either. So for people who are coming down the Mass Pike, it's this big, tall, majestic brick building on the right-hand side that you probably don't notice. You just assume it's a warehouse or something right before you go into the tunnel underneath the Prudential Center. But what it is, it's the Fenway Studios, built in the early 1900s as an artist enclave after another artist enclave in downtown Boston had been ruined by fire. A bunch of Bostonians got together. They built this building in the arts and crafts style. It was modeled after Parisian ateliers where some of the greatest painters of all time studied. And it's oriented so that it captures a north light with these soaring 12-foot-tall windows. Yeah. So the artists of Fenway Studios are about 42 artists there. They can only be painters. Many wait on the waiting list to get into the building for years and years and years. Some work there. Some live and work there in their studios.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Some of them do live there.
They do, because I spent time with one of the artists, Mary Hughes, and her two dogs, who are so great. But you walk into these balconies. The place is bathed in light. I'd always, of course, understood the importance of light when painting, but north light is unfiltered, hits these studios all day long, so these artists can work without artificial light, and the light doesn't change, and so it doesn't affect how they're rendering anything on the canvas.
Is there anything else? This is it for Boston, is it not? Is there any other artists-only kind of
Tremont,
thing like this?
In Tremont Street, there's the piano, the old Chickering Piano Factory. There are artists there too, but there are all kinds of artists. I think the rules are much looser there.
Yeah, speaking of the rules, so if you're on the waiting list, and I'm assuming you're dying to get in, and I mean that as a pun. Is that how you get in when someone dies? I assume you almost never give up this space,
yeah,
right?
I had another artist, Ed Stitt, who told me people only leave when they're carried out, basically, for
his
whatever
work is spectacular.
And everybody, so this is why we're talking about it now, because you know, there's the rotating spate of open studios throughout the city, and the Fenway open studios are this Saturday and Sunday, mm-hmm. and it's the only time of the year that you can go into the Fenway studios and pop into all of these different artist spaces.
That's
and
great.
See their work. Ed Stitt is a great painter and landscape painter.
Yes.
Mary Hughes, Kayla Mohammadi, who just had a major commission, I forget where it was, China or something like that. I mean, these are phenomenal artists. Ed Stitt has been working there for about 30 years. I mean, these are people working at the top of their craft.
He was
as the
gentleman that did these kind of weird scenes of like underpasses. Is that the gentleman? Oh,
yeah.
That you would never think to look at, really. And he captures them, like parts of the highway and the buildings behind them in this gorgeous light. It's just It's spectacular. He's so talented.
I love spending time with him. I felt like there's this whole group, this community that I didn't even know about. They're all making terrific work.
And a lucky 42 they are. So let's go to a place we know a lot about, the MFA. And they have an exhibit that obviously is the finest in the world, this Goya exhibit, yes?
The Goya show is spectacular, yeah. So the story here is that the MFA has always had this great relationship with Spain, going back generations to another curator who had worked with Spain a lot. And so they were able to procure these loans for this massive Goya show. There hasn't been one of this size in this country in more than 25 years. And so you have these two great curators, Frederick Ilchman and Stephanie Loeb Stepanek, who also has a great relationship with Spain, and they tell Goya's story, but very unconventionally. Goya is somebody who we know about his dark side. We know how he loved to paint witchcraft and devils and scenes of torture, but he also painted beautiful portraits and beautiful landscapes and still lifes. And they bring all of these elements together, and they don't do it chronologically because they contend that Goya bounced around all of these different themes throughout his lifetime.
So what did he do it thematically? Is that
You see his his bullfighting prints. There's this massive grand gallery they created of all his portraits, including the Duke and Duchess of Alba, first time possibly that they've ever been seen together. There's a fun little story there that the Duchess of Alba is pointing down to the ground, and on the ground in the sand is written "Solo Goya," as if only he could paint her. Maybe only he could paint her for a little relationship that they may or may not have had.
Well, he was supposedly carrying on with a lot of his subjects, wasn't he? Yeah, I think he got around. There are a lot of great stories about some young widow and the little black mantilla and what was really going on with her as well. And the great story about the picture, the self-portrait he did with his physician. Tell people that.
Yeah, it's called Self-Portrait with Dr. Arrieta, and it's toward the end of his life. Goya, it's remarkable how he painted, because at the end of his life, he had massive, massive health problems. And there's this picture of him in the embrace of his doctor, and Goya is so gaunt, and the color has gone out of his face. He painted this later when he was recovered. But in this sort of chapel-like room that they created, he's in this embrace with this light around them, his doctor looking down, his doctor in robust health. It's a very, very poignant moment. So you have all of these moments throughout the show, and it's called Order and Disorder because Goya lived in this time of American Revolution, French Revolution, Spain invaded, famine, torture, churches rising, churches falling. So Goya painted all of this, but with, as the curators told me, by putting order into it, you know, by creating beauty, by processing it on the canvas. It's such a great story.
And it's there through mid-January, correct?
It's there through January 19th.
Speaking of there through mid-January, I know you talked to Malcolm Rogers recently. We had him in studio, a month ago or so. What's the status of the post-Malcolm Rogers search? Where's that going?
I understand the search committee has been formed, and they're in the process of looking now, but that's all I know.
Did he say he stays until the successor arrives, yes?
Yep. So he announced, I think, last February or March, and even at that time they told me it would probably be about a year, if not longer, that Malcolm would stay until his successor is named.
You know, I just want to say, Jared Bowen, you're working very hard to see all this stuff and write about this stuff and do television reports and all this stuff. I shouldn't even call it stuff. You're really a busy guy.
Well, fortunately, I love it.
Okay, Jared Bowen is WGBH arts editor and the host of Open Studio, a fantastic show, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 on WGBH Channel 2. Jared, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to be joined by Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane. She's going to talk about the plight of 20 and 30-somethings, the millennials, who have to reinvent themselves over and over and over in the job market. We're going to talk to you about it and ask you if you're one of those millennials.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie. And everyone thought that daredevil, Nick Wallenda, was crazy to walk across a high wire 600 feet in the air above the Chicago River, blindfolded, by the way, without a net. What can seem just as terrifying? How about quitting your job with no backup plan? Well, it turns out it's what a lot of people in their 20s and 30s are doing. It may seem risky to other generations, but apparently not to millennials. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about jumping from one job to the next without a safety net is Nancy Kane. Nancy, as you know, is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey there, Nancy.
Hey there.
So I guess the bottom line here of this idea is that the millennials and 20-somethings, 30-somethings are the Nick Lendas of the job market, Nancy Kane. Is that correct?
I think that might just be a wee bit of a stretch, just a wee bit of a stretch. So the story or this subject, which is, you know, in the hearts and minds of lots of folks looking for work, not just millennials and not just their parents, right, because, you know, some sizable portion of folks that are born after 1981 are living at home if they're in between jobs or living at home if they're trying to save money or pay off college loans. It's also a big deal for lots of people looking to find work in an economy that is growing in very, very uneven ways, right, where there's lots of macro growth right now, but it's in uneven ways and it's rewarding people very unevenly. So the article that we're talking about is an article from the New York Times from November 8th by Hannah Seligson about, you know, kind of taking the leap and switching jobs. And she talks about she's 32 or 34, and she and her husband is roughly the same age. And he quit his job in Washington with the federal government to go to New York without having another job. And then she goes to a number of different people, all in their late 20s or early 30s, who decided to either lost their job and decided not necessarily to look for another job right away because they had a gap and they wanted to reconsider. Mm-hmm. They wanted the gap to reconsider. Or people that got downsized, Working Woman, the magazine that got downsized and, you know, reset and rebooted herself and decided to form her own business. And the point of the article
is... Or there's a third who weren't downsized, who weren't laid off, right, who just decided it's time for
it's
me.
Too time.
I need what is called a career interlude to figure out what I'm doing.
Right. So career interlude.
I love that expression.
Right. So the point of the article is really a rumination on new attitudes toward work. But it provoked or it opens the door on a broader subject, which is, one, the frequency with which younger people now switch jobs. There's an interesting Department of Labor statistic that workers between the ages of 18 and 26 hold 6.2 jobs on average. That's a lot.
That's
a lot. Well, if you start thinking about your own experience working during college and, you know, the last years of high school, it seems a little less, you know, out there. But that then leads into this broader set of numbers and observations. Columnists, sociologists, labor and work consultants checking in on what the future highway is for work and careers for people now in their 20s and early 30s. And there's a lot of hand-wringing and doom and gloom. One interesting article from Forbes.com or Forbeswoman.com was published on August 30th, 2012. Careers are dead. Welcome to your low-wage temp work future.
Yeah.
Right? Striking an optimistic tone about what this writer calls a disposable workforce. And then secondly, the idea that in a world in which the social contract, and we've talked about this on the show before, you folks, you and Jim and Marjorie have talked about it a lot in more general ways, that in a workforce and in a job situation or job environment in which the social contract of working for one company for a long time and, you know, and then collecting retirement is over and broken and not yet replaced by something that has any resemblance to that, we're all going to have to do a lot of reinvention. And so the general subject about the future of work for young people, older people, right, folks now in their late 50s and early 60s and even into their 70s, because lots of people are working into their 70s, is a fascinating, important topic. As a historian, once again, I don't see anything completely new under the sun. I mean, at the beginning of industrialization in the late 19th century, all kinds of people started on the farm, you know, took a career gap to move to the city, you know, started in stenography pools and worked their way up often, right? Or started on the floor of Marshall Field selling scarves and hats to other Chicago women and worked their way up to be department head. And so the history of work is actually a history in which the more common occurrence or more common equilibrium is of people constantly reinventing themselves over a lifetime, less about career, more about lots of different jobs. And where the exception is actually what we've known over the last 60 years, which is, you know, you go to work, you sign up with a company, you sign up with a couple of companies, and you build a career in that institutional frame.
Well, let me tell you, I come at this in a from the same place, but then take it in a slightly different direction. When I'm reading this piece that this woman wrote in the New York Times, I'm
Hannah
saying
Hannah Seligson,
whatever, yeah, Hannah Selig, whatever, Selig, sin, right? My apologies. I thought she was leaving one thing out, and then she didn't. Near the end, I was going to say, what are employers going to think about this? While the conventional wisdom is that employers like to see consistency, she writes, the ability to reinvent oneself as gaining currency is a sought-after talent. The analogy I made to this, both my kids took gap years. Mm-hmm. Gap years used to be anathema.
Yeah, right.
God, you're never going to go back to school. You don't really care about education. Now gap years, while not quite the norm, are growing. And in fact, as you know, Nancy Kane, you know, Marjorie, a ton of universities are encouraging gap years so you get your act together. This, to me, this career interlude thing, to use the term this writer uses, it seems to me is a variation on the theme. And what it basically says, I mean, if you're forced by economic necessity because you're fired, that's one thing. But if you make a choice to do this high wire act, either because you can afford to because you don't have a kid, you don't have a spouse, you don't have a whatever, or because you really do want to do this this reinvention thing, it really, in my mind, changes everything. And yet, because my attitude is most people I know who are 30, 40, 50, or 60 would love to be able to do this. They can't do it because of their own obligations. They can't do it because they're much more worried they won't find another job. They can't do it because they have several kids who are in college at $60,000 a year. So in many ways, you look at at least I look at these millennials with incredible envy that they have, some of them, a lot of them, have the courage and the risk-taking willingness to basically quit. You know what the question she asked at the beginning of the story is, when is it okay to quit a job without having another one?
Yeah.
You can never imagine having asked that question 20 years ago, because the answer then was, never is it okay, and now it apparently is.
Okay, so I think that's very, very interesting. A couple of flashes in response to that. First, I literally just walked out of a conference, an executive conference center at Babson, where I was coaching 60 really bright advertising executives, and we were talking about the millennials in the group and in their workforce who now have this kind of frame and view on work.
Mm-hmm.
And how, and thank you for being so candid, Jim, because someone finally kind of coughed up the candor and honesty and said, I'm actually a little jealous of them, right? That they you know, take time off in the middle of the day to go do a skateboarding lesson because they're going to work until midnight, but skateboarding is a really big deal for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we really do have an emerging and novel view of work. Second response, to be able to take a gap year and be able to say, okay, I'm going to quit my job and reboot myself, takes means. It takes economic means, right? You can't do that if you have no family. If you have no nest egg, you have no family financial support, you don't have a trust fund, it's very, I could not have done that. My parents couldn't have afforded a gap year for me. I was on scholarship. The scholarship only worked if I went straight on to college. So I think we have to remember that some of this risk-taking possibility, some of this ability comes from a generation that at least in certain zip codes has lived in great prosperity. Right, it's important. This is a very that what part of this is about the prosperity that has fueled some of these young people's rise. And my third response is, you know, and it's again related to this conversation I just facilitated, which I had less to do with than these very, very thoughtful people. And one of the men in the room was talking about how he has completely changed his idea of how his team works together because he has a whole lot of women who have had children, and how in the business in which it's all people and you need to be on all the time and you got to keep the client love train running like advertising, right? You have to be in the office or with the client. You can't be at home working on a part-time basis. Well, that too, that previously immovable tectonic plate has shifted as well. And he said, some of my most productive people, most creative people, are women who are now, right, compartmentalizing their work in new ways and coming into the office 3 days a week. So everywhere we turn, work, as we think about it, career making, I think, is being, shall we say, in an overused phrase, massively disrupted.
Wait a minute. Don't leave that for a second, because I find that very heartening that in advertising, which, as you say, you've got to be at the beck and call.
24/7.
Exactly. So how do these women that are home with their children part-time and working 3 days a week manage that if you know, Nestle's Crunch calls them or whoever it is at, you know, midnight and wants their attention? How do they...
Well, a lot of what they do is say, I can't talk to you now, but I can talk to you then. So we actually do a whole session on training your clients, right? Like training your team or training your boss that you know, you don't have to answer emails in the first 2 seconds or in the first, you know, 12 hours that they appear. That's a kind of whole nother sidebar.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
Oh, yeah. I do a whole section on the power of doing nothing right away. And I tell this story. I'm sorry. You can't have a segment without me talking about Lincoln, of Lincoln writing this letter, right, when he was really, really angry at George Meade after the Battle of Gettysburg because Meade didn't attack Lee on his retreat. And Lincoln writes this really angry letter. It's 3 pages. It's, you disappoint me. You could have ended the war. I can't tell you what this has cost us. And he folds it all up, and he seals it all up, and he writes to George Meade. And then on the back of it, he writes the date. Right, signed but never sent, because he didn't think if he reacted in a minute it would serve him and the country well, because he didn't want to alienate the West Point brass. So I do this whole session on what if you don't do anything right now? What if you don't react right now? What will happen? And so part of what these women that are working, you know, on in limited frames of time do is do their work when they do it, and then they step back. And guess what? What this manager, this executive was saying is it can work really well.
That's wonderful.
I want to get back to this whole I want to get back to the topic at hand just for a second. Yeah. So, you know, we talk about the millennials' political attitudes a lot on this show. And we say, well, when the 25-year-old becomes a 45-year-old, I mean, here's a good the best example is gay marriage. We talk about a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, over something like even, I think it's 71% of Republican millennials, and maybe off by one or two, support gay marriage. When they become the 40-year-olds, the whole debate is over. Not that it's not pretty close to all over right now, depending on what the Supreme Court does somewhere down the line. But on this issue, I say to myself, when these millennials get married, have kids, have responsibilities, are they going to become exactly like us? Or is that willingness to take risks and have these interludes going to stay with them? Because I have to say, the reason I was against this whole gap year thing for my kids, and I changed my mind, there is no question that if you step back from what you're doing, I don't care if you're 20, 30, or 50, and take a minute or a month or a year to actually think about it, you're probably going to do better, even if you decide going back to the exact same thing that you did before. So the question is, will it continue as they age, or is it just a function of this group of 18 to 28 years old?
See, I think we will get more of this. I don't think I don't think it's just about youth and means and some kids that have the wherewithal financially to do this. I think it's about really huge shifts in the global, you know, market for work. I really do. I think each of us, including all of us, are roughly the same age, right? Whatever. Yeah. We're boomers. We're all boomers sitting around
boomers.
This table, and lots of our listeners. I think that we will, if we choose to work, and many of us will, choose to work into our 70s, we'll be doing something very different, right, when we're 68 or 72. We'll be doing something very different because the nature of what is demanded by the marketplace and all this uneven growth, right, and not a kind of steady state expansion across the global workplace is going to cause each of us, in some sense, to fit ourselves, not just from the inside out, but partly from the demand for labor outside, inside, to fit ourselves to new marks, as Shackleton would say, a man must fit himself to a new mark when the time changes, right? We must fit ourselves. I think we'll all be doing a lot more entrepreneurial kind of, I don't mean starting our own business, but entrepreneurial approaches to looking for work, resetting, rethinking, and remaking ourselves. Think about all the people. And I know many of them. Think about limo drivers. Almost every limo driver that you're ever with, right, and many, many taxi drivers have at least two other lines of work, right? Most of them never started in any of those lines of work, including driving, right? And they are not just an isolated example. They are about a new economy, right, that demands different things and has more increasingly large amounts of flexibility built in and harshness and less social safety net back to our, you know, Nick
Wallenda.
Thank you. Back to Nick Wallenda. And so I think that there are costs to that already, but it will demand more innovation and instinct and creativity on the part of each individual, and less looking to institutions, government, corporations, you know, large scale companies to somehow figure this out for the individual. I think we'll all be looking more like millennials in 15 years than we can anticipate right now.
I hope you're right.
You know, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, we have a question from one of our colleagues, Callie Crossley, who wants to know what about companies like Apple and Google that offer professional sabbaticals.
That's a great question.
Are they more likely to keep millennials in the ranks?
So a couple of comments about both those companies and some other interesting foresighted companies that believe that all they really have for assets are the creativity and innovation of their people. That's describing a lot of parts of the new economy. Yes, they believe this will be attractive to millennials. They also believe it'll be good business because they think that people that go away, back to the point of even like the women stepping away from being on email all the time, or Lincoln not having email and hitting send, George Meade, of course, a world history could have been different, right? They believe that stepping back is actually going to be very good for those people's ability to rethink, re-envision the next Google innovation. You know, Google also has something else in exactly the same spirit. It's part of, again, this new kind of new world of work where I think it's Fridays. Every Friday, you can work on something that has nothing to do with Google stuff on office time.
Really?
Now, you don't tell – they're not doing this, like, you know, to, like, feed your soul. Or if they are, there's the business case for feeding your soul, which is go work on this invention or this gadget or this really new idea about, you know, how you can stream something on the internet. And by the way, chances are that'll benefit Google. Even the program I teach in is all about bringing them away from the office, reset them, reboot them, not just for their agency and their teams and their creative product and the kind of, you know, awards they can win at AdFest, bring them away so they can reboot with themselves because it's going to help them, and that means it's most likely really going to help their people and their creativity and their clients.
Yeah, I'm going to get back to the non-millennials for a second. If you had I think I can fairly say that between the three of us, I think this is a fair statement, you can't find three people who love what they do much more than we do. Is that a fair?
I would say I'm very
and
lucky.
And Nancy, that's true for you
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely.
But to take this theme again, if you had an opportunity in 3 years or 4 years to say the thing you've been dying to do that you haven't been able to do for whatever reasons, financial, whatever, or time, you can go do. You could at least take it. Wouldn't that have tremendous appeal to you?
Oh, yes. I think that's one of the
point
things.
Is, I think everybody would like to do this, is what I'm saying.
Journalists used to get, and they get paid for them. I don't know if they still do, the Nieman Fellowship at Harvard or the Knight Fellowship at Stanford, where you go for a year and your company still pays you, the difference between what the school pays you and what the company pays you. So you get your salary and you go for a year to one of the great universities in the world and study whatever you want. I mean, phenomenal, phenomenal opportunity. And people come back, you know, they work on their novel or they read, you know, they read the Divine Comedy, whatever they wanted to do, and it's fantastic. But those opportunities are few and far between.
They are, but I can tell you, as someone who's worked with some of those people and done all kinds of work now on different modes of motivating and sustaining, a lot of this is about sustaining your gifts, right, over time in a very reactive, increasingly 24/7 kind of workplace for lots and lots of people in different industries. I can tell you that the evidence on the results of this in terms of what you go back to or what you return or what you do differently is unequivocal that people are better for this moment, this reset.
Because
this
if you go back, you've decided you really want it as opposed
back.
To just doing it because that's what you've been doing.
Exactly.
I mean, it's
and
so
you,
obvious to me.
And you go back with a fresh perspective and you go back with how the Divine Comedy matters to this, you know, this very interesting legal case I'm putting together. You go back restored and refreshed and with a different frame. And that is very, very, very important. It's important for leaders. It's important for mothers, it's important for all of us, and we can't all have the luxury of having a gap year or taking a year off or leaving a job because we don't like it or we just want to reboot. We can't all do that. We can build small aspects of this into our lives.
Okay, now in a couple of minutes after Nancy goes, we're going to take your phone calls. If you're millennials, we're going to ask you if you have encountered this kind of situation, if you've become a risk taker, and we're going to ask you if you aren't a millennial, did quitting a job without a backup plan give you the drive you needed to find that next job, or were you too scared to do it? But before, for weeks, Nancy has been teasing us with a poem she wrote long ago about, it's about two mothers, is it
yes,
not?
It's
now,
about,
whose mothers would they
okay,
be?
Okay, it's called, the poem is called Nancy and Iris. It's about Lincoln's mother, Nancy Hanks, Hanks Lincoln, and Paul Hewson, which is Bono's given birth name, Paul Hewson, Iris Hewson, his mother. Just coincidentally, I finished this poem only really finished it about a month ago. I started it many years ago and didn't feel I could complete it. It was too ambitious for me. I'm not sure if that's right or wrong, but it is completed. And I wrote it because I was so struck by how the effect that each of their mothers each died when they were very young. Surprisingly, unexpectedly, suddenly, and I was very impressed as I read about each of these people in different contexts, how much they were affected by that, and how much their leadership was affected.
Hold on, before you do the poem, what happened to Bono's mother?
She had a brain hemorrhage at her father's funeral. Her father had dropped dead the morning after his golden wedding anniversary celebration with her mother. And he had died in his sleep. She was organizing the funeral. 3 days later, after his death, in the churchyard, she dropped dead. She had brain hemorrhage, and she was on life support for 4 days.
Wow. So she was in her 40s or 50s or something? Wow. Yeah.
So this is called Nancy and Iris.
It's called Nancy and Iris, okay?
Take it away, Nancy Kane.
They live in the shadows now, placeholders for the past. Terrible it was for each of their sons. The leave-taking so sudden, unthinkable, even as it happened. Nancy's boy ran wild in the woods, feeding on squirrels and Indiana acorns. Savage-like, he and his sister waited for Tom to come back with his gun and his new bride. Before his father left, they had made the box, the boy carving the pegs for the corners while Tom hewed the long slats. Then it was time. She vanished below. The grave, windswept, unresisting, as the panther's scream filled the night and the 9-year-old boy with fear. Across an ocean and the years that piled on toward our time, the son of Iris bounced off the walls in the Dublin house, skirting round the black hole of grief and the blood at the churchyard gate. The hole grew wide and then deep. The weeks became months and then years. His father would not speak of the collapse that became an ending. It had come so quickly, the brain bleed at her father's funeral, 4 days on life support. Her sons called in to say goodbye as Sarah and Abe had stood by Nancy's bedside in an older time. Iris lay immobile while her children crept in, faces drawn. A switch was pulled. He felt the house come crashing down. Cut adrift in space and time, he staggered farther, deeper into his 14th year. From the shadows, each woman looked on as her son tried to walk on. At times, each stumbled into blackness, dark and deep and unrelenting. They both ran from the emptiness, Abe into books, ideas, away out of his father's life. Paul, later Bono, into music, a girl with Spanish eyes. While his father said, "Don't dream." The boys became men and still they ran, recognition, a public stage, pulling them on, the specter of redemption behind the milestones. For Nancy's son, a court case won. The next election, an audition at Cooper Union, right makes might, daring to do our duty. The scene was then transported, and the war came. Sumter, Shiloh, Antietam, Gettysburg, fiery trial. From deep within, a wellspring of compassion and vision. From these honored dead, he found increased devotion to save the Union and change it. Transmuting the base metal of his grief, our grief, into terrible, almighty gold. A new birth of freedom, mined at fearsome cost now and then. The son of Iris took up his pickaxe. He had found platinum after chasing record contracts, fans, top of the charts. Now he wanted more, a bigger stage, a broader quest. He dug for justice, debt relief, medicine, music, and politics. Where you live should not decide whether you live or whether you die. Ireland and Africa, Iris inside him, and now in others around the world. Nancy and Iris, do they know, these two women, ripped so early from their sons, what their boys did with all the love? What they still do from the black hole, the shock and awe that was their mother's leaving?
Oh. Is that worth the wait, Nancy Kane? You are amazing.
God, that was
Nancy
terrific.
And Iris.
Is there anything you can't do over there, Nancy
Kane?
That's what
I
want to
thank
know.
You. That was a great honor.
That was great.
Thank you, dear readers. Thank you, dear listeners.
That was great. I think we should put that in your next book.
Can we make that available online for people?
Sure.
We will. That'll be available on WGBHnews.org by the end of the day.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Nancy Kane. That
Nancy
was breathtaking.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Rosen Chair of Business Administration. She also, obviously, is a poet, and her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. She joins us every Tuesday. Thank you, Nancy. Up next, we're going to ask you guys, have you quit a job without a backup plan? Was it the best thing you did or something you'll regret? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we were talking about quitting your job without a backup plan. It's common, apparently, amongst millennials, less so among people who grew up with the words job security drilled into their work ethic. Millennials, we want to hear from you. We know a lot of you are facing student loan debt in the face of mounting bills. Do you feel okay about quitting a job without a backup plan? And if you have, has it worked for you? 877-301-8970. We don't want you non-millennials to feel left out. Give us a call, too. Did quitting a job without a backup plan give you the drive you needed to find that next job, or did it alienate you from the workforce and your bank account? 877-301-8970. As I said to Nancy, this has colossal allure. And I mean this. I don't think I know anybody who likes what they do more than I do. But why are you laughing at me?
Because I think of all the careers you've told me that you were going to take up. First, you're going to be a carpenter.
Then I wasn't going to be a carpenter. I said I'd like to have those skills.
A car shrink wrapper. That was another one.
I was going to say, I thought I could make a lot of money if you shrink wrap car. That wasn't like
a
career thing.
Weren't you starting some falafel business in Chicago or something?
No, I don't want to talk about it in the air because I'm still thinking of doing it.
So okay.
Not
falafels?
Tell me. I mean, well, I'm not letting it. You've talked. The people will find this to be incredibly odd. You have a desire to be a flower arranger.
I do.
Do you not in your later life?
Well, I'd like to work in a nursery, a greenhouse.
But how great would that be?
I mean, it'd be great.
The notion of having the freedom when you're young, as these millennials do. I have to say, I know nothing about, other than what I've read today, about how how employers and the whole workplace views this. It's the smartest thing. I mean, it's sort of, as I said, it's sort of like the gap year. You have an opportunity to take a broader look at the world rather than just be on the same path you've been on for 10 years or 40 years or something.
Very nerve-wracking.
What?
I'd be a nervous wreck.
Well, of course. Well, for financial reasons.
For financial reasons, but just for even when I was young, I remember worried about if I quit my job to go do something else, I'd never get another one.
No, I understand.
Or I'd never get as good of a job.
I understand. And obviously the stakes are much lower
millennials.
Not working in a nursery?
No. I told you this. I had a chance to go to Africa for 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
I said no, because I just got a job at the Boston Globe, actually, years ago, and I didn't go, and I should have gone.
Was that when you told yesterday when your boyfriend put a lit cigarette in his pocket because the coach of the basketball team was about to see him smoking?
Set himself on fire
and
went off to Senegal.
877-301-8970. Again, if you're a millennial, have you done what the New York Times is talking about, which is with, a high wire act with no net, just said, I'm done with this. I'm going to look around till I find something that suits me better. And if you're older than a millennial, if you haven't done it, is there not a great urge in you to do it? And I think the answer is it exists in everybody. Let's go to South Attleboro, where Janice is on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Janice.
Hey, how are you doing, Jim?
Excellent. We're good. Glad to talk to you. It's not a great connection, so let's try to see what we can do, Janice.
Okay, how about it? Is that any better?
It's good enough. Let's try it.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I have, there are four girls in my family, and of the four of us, three of us have quit jobs, emotionally quit jobs. I just left one of my sisters, who's the only one of the four of us to keep a job for more than 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we were wondering how that happened. But anyway, we are a very emotional family. Three of us have quit and gained new jobs. And so I would say that this show today kind of caught my ear. And I said, oh, my God, I just had lunch with my sister. I've got to share this.
But Janice, before you go ahead, have you and your sisters left jobs because, well, for what reason? Why the change? Was it self-motivated, or did the employer suggest it's time to go?
No, it was never the employer suggested it was time to go. It was, I hate to say, we're kind of emotional, passionate people, and we get our feelings hurt very easily, and I think we kind of get frustrated or upset with something that's going on.
I understand that, and also something new looks very appealing. Janice, the connection is horrible, but thank you very kindly for the call. I mean, it's obvious that it's both thrilling and frightening simultaneously to take a chance like that. But it is the appeal of it is, the physical feeling, it's hugely appealing.
Okay, you're going to love this, Jim.
What's that?
We just got an email from Jay sending us a quote from the Dalai Lama.
What did he say?
Ready? Take into account that both great love and great success involve great risk.
Of course.
How about that?
I think I'm the one who told the Dalai Lama that. I believe he got it from me, but I can't say that for certain. Okay. Travis, you're in Revere. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Great. Excellent. Thank you.
What do you think?
So I'm a millennial, 26. I'm calling from the other end. I graduated with 2 engineering degrees and $130,000 in debt.
Oh, goodness.
After 3 years of paying it off, I'm down to $130,000. Job security still very much so means a great deal to me because the minimum payments on my loans, I live with my parents. I only have so much money to my name, you know, every month. And, I try to keep from getting bitter hearing a lot of my peers and shows like this talk about the break years people take. And, oh, you travel abroad, you go spend some time in university. Oh, no. These things are just simply never an option for me. It was go to work, pay the debt. And before it was go to work, it was go to school. So I did leave a job this past February. I left a really big name jet engine manufacturing company due to the culture of the place, namely that being behind a desk for 8 hours a day staring at a screen makes me very sad.
But Travis, in light of your colossal debt, were you not nervous about did you have another job when you left the prior one?
Yes.
Oh, well, okay.
Yes, that's
okay.
The difference. I could never be without income. I simply could not. So,
and you know something, Travis? I was just going to say, I think you are singing the song of an awful lot of kids. This is a luxury to be able to have, you know, time off. You have to have somebody to support you, either your spouse or your parents or your own trust fund. You're absolutely right. You're in the same boat as lots of kids.
Right. And you know, there's a lot of talk of, what's going on with the economy and you know, why isn't our generation buying houses? Why aren't we settling down? What do we really want to shoulder another third of what I have in debt? You know,
Travis, are you aware of the fact that total student loan indebtedness is $1 trillion nationally and is on the verge of overtaking mortgage indebtedness as the great debt scandal of this country? And Travis, thanks for your call. He's the perfect example. This is not our topic of the day, but I'm so glad he called. So many people who are young and not so young have to make career choices totally as a function of where they can make money that will allow them to pay off their loans, as opposed to what will make them happiest or most satisfied, they think. And so he's lost that freedom, as many people do.
Just a very, very quick aside, I don't know how we're going to have in the future social workers and teachers and assistant district attorneys and public defenders, because they can't afford to take jobs which pay $35,000 a
year. There's got to be loan forgiveness programs. That's the only way it'll ever work.
That's the only way it's going to work. Otherwise, you can't afford to do that. You're going to pay 3 years of law school. You can't possibly do it. You'll have to go become a tax lawyer. Imagine being a tax lawyer. I'm sure there are people that love being a tax lawyer. I can't imagine doing it.
It's the only course I got an A in law school, by the way.
Well, you're very good at taxes, Jim. You know, I've always said that about you.
He was 26 years old, $136,000 in debt. I mean, that's $136,000 after taxes, meaning he has to make and have a spare, $210,000? Over the next handful of years to pay off it's obscene. It's just, and by the way, this is not our topic, but when Congress had that orgasmic celebration a few years ago when they cut the interest rates on these Stafford loans, these subsidized loans, I've said repeatedly, how much that saved the average loan, the borrower?
Some tiny
$6 a month. That'd be worth a lot to Travis.
Michael in Boston, what do you think, Michael?
Hi, Michael.
Hey, hi, guys. Great to talk with you. You guys are a real asset to the Boston scene. Thanks.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Absolutely. I love listening to you guys.
Thanks.
So listen, my story is, I think, a story of hope. I'm a baby boomer. I was forced into retirement last year. I was left out of a divorce, indigent, blah, blah, blah. You don't need the details. But I've been a serial entrepreneur my whole life. I'm kind of geared to be able to go and have, you know, a roller coaster ride and have a lot of different experiences through my career. And long story short, 6 months ago, I got a job as a limo driver, and it has allowed me to do other things that I want to explore, you know, photography that I didn't have a lot of time for, additional filmmaking that I wanted to do, and also some internet projects. So I just wanted to give it as a story of hope that, you know, for baby boomers, it's not all the bad thing. It's great to be able to reinvent, and that's what I've been doing.
You know,
that's pretty
Michael,
great, Michael,
when you're a limo driver, say you're bringing your customer to some big event at the Four Seasons or something, then you have like a few hours between the time you have to pick them up, right? Does that happen to you sometimes, where you have like spare time to sit around and do these other things while you're waiting for the other half of the evening?
Absolutely. Like today, I'm on a what they call a road show. I'm taking a college, potential high school student for college, taking her to Boston College, to BU, to Northeastern, while they tour the college. So there's a two-hour window between each of those stops. And I get to do my other work. I bring my laptop with me, my iPad, and I'm able to explore the other stuff. It also gives me those two-hour windows of telephone time during the day that I can have the business meetings that I need to have, conferencing and so forth, and all utilizing the technology. So it's tough to get jobs when you're over 65. I think employers are still a little reticent about it, and I hear what you guys are saying, that maybe they are looking for that. It's hard-pressed to find employers, at least from my experience, for what I would call real JOBs, JOBSs, to get an employer to look at someone who's got a diverse career. You know, if you haven't stayed with one particular, you know, job and get expertise, they kind of dismiss you, in my opinion.
Right.
And, you know, where I've had this huge background in transportation and hospitality and you name it, I've been a developer. I've done all kinds of things in my life. It's been a wonderful thing. And but you put a resume out, and of course, with the technology, you put it out on the internet, and you don't get answers. You don't know. There's no feedback as to why you might have been rejected, why you're not qualified. So I think there's still that stigma there, and it's very tough for people that are baby boomers to get jobs, if not just part-time jobs.
Michael, I love the term serial entrepreneur. And secondly, not that you need my advice, you should write a piece for The Globe or The Globe magazine about your career. I'm serious. Your career exploits. It is a story of hope, and we're glad you shared it with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks for your comment. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thanks so much. By the way, do you remember what Nancy said a while ago? She says, when she was with us, Nancy Kane, you get a cab driver, you get a limo driver like Michael, who have a couple other things going on the side. I think she was talking about second and third jobs. Michael's talking about his entrepreneurial self. It allows him, that job allows him to do the kinds of things that, I guess, the risk-taking that 25-year-olds can do even without an income. I think it was a great story.
Cynthia said she quit her job and stepped out on faith. My last job 11 years ago working in a fitness resource center, but the staff smoked weed all the time during lunch. And it was very, very crazy there. She's forced to quit. The next day, she got her dream job as a Trader Joe's artist. There you go.
Well, I mean, I'm telling you.
A happy ending.
I think Michael was a happy ending, too. I mean, or at least, it's not an ending, a happy middle. Let's go to Cyrus. I believe it's Cyrus at BU. Hi, Cyrus.
Yeah, hello. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, guys.
Sure.
I'm calling because I was so interested in this discussion. I'm the assistant director of a program that BU hosts. It's run by the State Department, actually, in D.C. Mm. It's called the Humphrey Fellowship Program, and it brings mid-career professionals from developing countries to the U.S. to spend a year at a university and to do professional affiliations at agencies and corporations that are related to their respective fields. And the reason I wanted to call is because, excuse me, I'm out of breath because I was running.
That's okay.
The agencies that host our fellows for 6 weeks or 8 weeks at a time. This is like the FDIC or the Securities and Exchange Commission, National Geographic. They are so refreshed by the presence of these people who are in the middle of their golden year. You know, like they're never going to have a year again off until they're retired.
Yeah.
And they are so eager to just soak it all in. And,
It's also, I assume the reason they're attractive in part because the employers of the places they're placed know they really want it as opposed to just being deposited. Cyrus, we got to go, but tell us the name of the program again, please.
Yeah, it's the Humphrey Fellowship Program at BU.
Great. We'll check it out.
Thank you. Sorry we had to go so quickly. Thank you. And sorry we didn't get to the rest of the calls either, but thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, Juliet Kayyem joins us for Open Mic. We'll also check in with Boston Pops Orchestra Music Director Keith Lockhart and the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, is with us as well. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen make up our team, and our engineer is John Parker. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm part of the team, too, aren't
I? You're part of the team, Jim Browdy. Okay.
Well, then I'm Jim Browdy.
Okay. See you later. Thank you very much for tuning in. Bye.